Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our council meeting, and this is Tuesday, March 25th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnett?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Here. Item 3 is our flag salute. We're very pleased to have Brownie Troop 41016 here to do our flag salute. And also, after the flag salute, if you would please remain standing for our invocation. Pastor David Bergeson is here from First United Methodist Church to do that for us. So, we can all stand now.
To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Not yet. Let me pray first. Let's pray. Creator God, we come and we thank you. We thank you for the many blessings of our city, the people and places, for our city council and for our mayor and their families, and for all the families represented in this wonderful city. For all the people who work behind the scenes in our city government, we give you thanks. Be with all tonight who move through this time of meeting and looking at the items on agenda, listening and discussing, and we always give you thanks. In the name of the Holy One, I lift this prayer. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. Okay, ladies, could I ask you to do me a favor? Could you back up a little bit here so everybody can see you? And this is the time when we get to hear about all the fun things that your Brownie Troop is doing. So who wants to start off?
This year, we spent the night and we went hiking.
For our service project, we are donating money to Woods Humane Society and ASPCA.
For one of our fun activities, we are going to have a bowling sleepover.
For one of our activities, we are going to the Ravine Water Park.
We brought one of our boxes of Girl Scout cookies. They're called Thanks a Lot, and they are new this year. They have thank you on the cookies in five different languages.
Okay. We brought them to share with you to thank you for serving our community.
Thank you.
I think the girls wanted to also introduce themselves, right, and say their ages and where you go to school.
I'm 8 years old, and my name's Allie, and I go to Harlow.
I am Emma, and I go to Ocean View Elementary, and I'm 9 years old.
I'm Logan, and I go to Ocean View, and I'm 9.
I am Lily. I am 8 years old, and I go to Dorothy Lang Elementary.
I'm Natalie, and I go to Trivium Charter, and I'm 8 years old.
Okay, is that it?
That's it.
All right, you did a wonderful job. Okay, ladies, will you, before you leave, will you come back and do our flag salute for us again? We really appreciate it. You did a good job. Okay, we'll see you next time. Thank you. Well, I don't know what the rest of the council is going to have, but... Okay, moving on to item 5, agenda review. Item 5 is closed session. We have no announcements for closed session. Item 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Children and families can play, learn, interact with the agencies and programs providing services throughout the county. And whereas Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month is a time to recognize opportunities for children and to commit ourselves to ensuring that each and every child experiences a high-quality environment at home, at childcare, at school, and in the community that will promote their optimal development. And whereas every moment in a child's life is an opportunity for that child to learn, and that the quality of these experiences may determine whether a child succeeds in school and in life, and that all children need caring and loving adults in their lives. And whereas this month's activity will provide an opportunity to acknowledge youth, early care and education programs and their dedicated staff, and to raise the awareness of the community, employers, and elected officials of the need to improve the quality, availability, and accessibility of such programs. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim April 2014 as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month, and April 12, 2014 as the Day of the Child. And may we remember to listen to and watch the children around us, to have patience and to allow them the opportunity to enjoy the journey of childhood. Maddie, as always, it's a pleasure to present this to you. And I know you have some words for us.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor Tony Ferrara and the City Council of Arroyo Grande. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to accept the proclamation on behalf of the Child Care Planning Council, which mission is to plan for and promote the highest quality and accessible services for the care of all children and youth. And like you heard earlier, April 12th in Mission Plaza, the Child Care Planning Council will be hosting Children's Day in the Plaza. Also, we would like to thank you for recognizing April as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month as we work together as a community to ensure that our children are our highest priority. As the Arroyo Grande United Methodist Children's Center, we are honored to be here tonight accepting this proclamation. And we'd like to tell you a little bit about ourselves. We opened our door in 2005 with three children, and today we serve 48 children ages 18 months to 5 years of age. And we're open from 7 to 5:30 daily. And we're located on 275 North Halcyon Road, right here in Arroyo Grande. We'd like to thank the mayor for attending our 6th annual Family Fun Day last October. Our event was a success, and we were able to raise almost $1,700 to buy needed supplies for the program. We are a nonprofit, and we appreciate all the support that we get from the community. And we again look forward to our 7th annual Family Fun Day event, and we hope the mayor can attend that event again, too, to kick off the event. And I do have a thank you letter that I'll present to you in a few minutes. Also, during the Month of the Young Child, we have a Family Fun event planned, and the whole community is invited. It's Thursday, April 10th at the First United Methodist Church. We'll have a pizza party at 6, followed by a concert at 6:30 with Ivan Oltz. And again, the community is invited, and tickets are $8 at the preschool. And also that same night, the Children's Center will be having an open house, and that's free. And we welcome all to come and see what we have to offer to the community. So again, tonight we have families and staff and children of our program. And I'd like for them to come up now to present the artwork that they have. We have Miss Rebecca, our pre-K teacher, Cindy Bowe, our young toddler teacher, and Miss April is also here, right? Oh, she was here. She's our older toddler teacher. And thank you again for accepting this artwork that the children made, and you can display that here in your chambers to brighten up your chambers.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
better than cooking
fish.
I didn't see that. Yeah, it might pass me.
There's more of your speed right there.
Since I took it, I'll take it now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Maddie, and thanks for the great program that you have here and for all the goodies. And we're going to display this artwork just like we did last year. It'll be up through the month of April. Okay, thank you. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters not published on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Please address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward, community comments and suggestions, once again, items not on this evening's agenda. And good evening, Otis.
My name's Otis Page, 606 Middle Street, Arroyo Grande. That's a tough act to follow. I think it's time for this council to embrace the fact that there's a critical need by the city in its finances. The exercise of Proposition 218 is the use of Proposition 218 is a legal appropriate measure to help fund various problems the city may face. At this point, the citizens of the city probably are not aware of 218, how it's going to be used by the city in a very appropriate way, because you have financial problems that maybe the city do not understand or appreciate. We proceed in faith that you're doing all the right things for the city in this regard, but there may be misunderstandings because of the critical things that are happening, such as the fire authority tax and other items that you're addressing in tonight's agenda. I'm saying that it's probably appropriate to declare exactly where we stand as a city, so there'll be no misunderstandings of this. Thank you.
Thank you. And just a note, Otis, there have been a couple of issues that came up. I was gone for 10 days, and with regard to the 218, during staff communication, Tim is going to provide some additional information on that. You might want to tune in. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Items not on the agenda tonight.
Good evening. My name is Joe Farino. I live on North Elm Street in the city of Arroyo Grande. I come before you tonight. You may recall I attended several of the advisory committees for the Charter City. I've spoken here before, primarily in favor of keeping everything as factual and neutral as possible, giving our citizens the greatest chance to make the wisest choice. I recently received the flyer that was sent out with taxpayer money, and I must say I am quite disappointed. I don't know who approved it. I don't know what they thought about it. But it did not seem to really follow any type of neutral or factual basis, in my opinion. One of the first things it starts off with is it says Arroyo Grande has the opportunity to do something. I would think that the word option really states it much better. We have an option to choose yes or no. When you say opportunity, you make it seem as if, boy, this is something really good. This is your chance. You better get it now. The reason I put it that way is when I was in my first marriage, my brother-in-law sold timeshares. And timeshare salesmen are always trying to impress you with an opportunity, and time is running out. You better grab it now. And one of the things they do is they try and take your eye off the ball, and they introduce other things that may confuse the issue. In this piece, it has quite a lot in here about SB 7. something that actually doesn't exist. SB 7 was a Senate Bill 7. It is no longer a Senate bill. It's the law of the land. So why we're talking about SB 7, I don't know. It says in here it's a recent bill passed by the legislature. Well, when I was in junior high school, I learned that when a bill is passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, it's no longer a bill. It's state law. Now, it goes on to surmise that it will be challenged, and it further speculates that upon challenge, it may or may not be reversed. That's hardly factual data, in my opinion. That's a lot of speculation and maybe. Some attorney somewhere thinks it'll be overturned. I got news. I know a lot of attorneys. You get me in a room with 10 attorneys, 5 will take one side, 5 will take the other, and they'll all take the money. So, that being said, I'm really disappointed that we bring what they call SB 7 into this whole thing, because SB 7 will have no effect on what the city refers to as. I'm just greatly disappointed by language like opportunity and trying to cloud the issue by adding things that have no direct bearing. And I know the mayor at one time was quite upset when one of the two viewpoints mischaracterized things in a flyer. And that upsets me too. I don't want to see this process hijacked by the cheerleaders of one side or the other. I want to see a central point where we can make intelligent discussion and rely on the facts. And I must say that I'm greatly disappointed that my tax dollars went to this, which I just cannot believe was not written by someone obviously on one side of the issue. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Once again, items not on the agenda tonight.
My name is Audrey Howard, and I live at 996 Robin Circle in Aurora Grande. And it's my understanding that the city council at the next meeting will be undertaking to approve or disapprove a resolution about allowing people to rent rooms on a short-term basis in private homes. Now, I object to this for a lot of reasons, but the main reason I object to it is that I think it puts our little children at risk. It's a our neighborhood happens to be a small neighborhood, and children play outside skateboarding and hopscotch and shooting baskets, and they're not necessarily under the watchful eye of their mother at every minute, as kids play in the street for years. weren't. So I just want to cite my objection to that, and also to mention that I was a little disappointed that I found this out through the grapevine that this was in the works, and that to my knowledge, the community was never officially notified of this plan. So that was one of the things that bothered me, but the rest is mainly about the children and putting them at risk. And we've got, what, the month of the child or the day of the child we just did, and their safety. So I think it'd be pretty easy for somebody to scoop up one of those kids out on the sidewalk. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Mr. Mayor? Just on the last speaker, I don't want to comment on her comments, but I do want to clarify the date. She had mentioned the item being on the next council meeting, and at this point, that item is scheduled on the April 22nd agenda. So I just wanted to make sure everyone knows the correct date of that meeting.
Okay. All right. Did you all get that? Not April 8th, April 22nd. Okay. So it won't be the next council meeting.
Hi. Thank you, Council. I used to sell timeshares, so when I was in my early 20s, it wasn't any fun. I too, here am to address the short-term rental situation that is being proposed on the 22nd.
Excuse me, can we get your name, please?
I'm sorry, I'm Michael Howard, and I live on Robin Circle in Rio Grande. I've written a few notes. I'd just like to express myself. Good evening. My name is Michael, and I'm a lifetime resident of the city of Rio Grande. I'm here tonight to express my opposition to the Planning Commission's recommendation to allow transient homestays in our residential neighborhoods here in the city of Rio Grande. If the City Council votes to allow homestays in our residential neighborhoods, it will essentially allow my neighbor or your neighbor or any resident in the city, for that matter, to take a photograph of their guest bedroom, post it on the internet for the world to see, and rent it out to any given stranger, just like a hotel, in my opinion. This would be a remarkable and dramatic shift away from the neighborhoods that we currently live in and have grown up in here in Rio Grande. We should all carefully consider the ramifications of allowing this Pandora's box of unintended consequences to be opened up in our city and into our neighborhoods. People are advertising these rooms on the internet almost exclusively due to its far-reaching capabilities. Do we really want to open up our private neighborhoods to the 2 billion individuals surfing the internet? Based on their report, the Rio Grande Planning Commission is attempting to place this type of lodging under the current bed and breakfast codes already on the books. Now, I have to take a bit of money to run their business. Like most businesses in our city, there are several motels that are owned by individuals and not big corporations. Is it fair to them that they pay all the overhead of running a business only to be undercut by the owner of a 3-bedroom house on Oak Park Boulevard? What will happen to the quality of life in Berry Gardens when half of the homes turn into transient rental dwellings? What will a neighborhood look like when half of the homes have travelers coming in and out for their weekend at the sand dunes or their buddy's bachelor party at the coast? What do we tell a single mother of three who relies on the familiarity of her neighbors as she raises her 3 children in a home where strangers are now coming and going nightly next door? What about our current sex offender laws that keep predators away from children and schools? Can a registered sex offender now rent a room in my neighbor's home without anybody knowing the better? Just look on any of the websites that offer this service. They do not background check their users. This is my concern as a father. In closing, I'd like to say that when my wife and I go out in public with our children, our parental instincts kick in and they go up as we are no longer at home. Whether it's a trip to the store, a play date at the park, or a vacation at Disneyland, we're on a higher alert when keeping watch over our children. But when we go home, the guard can go down a little bit. It's a safe, familiar environment. My children can play outside as we know who our neighbors are. And if the neighbors invite friends over to their home, they know who they are. But if we allow this into our neighborhoods, then that familiarity will disappear altogether. This new notion is not a good fit for our little town, and I think the good majority of residents would agree with me. I encourage every resident of the city of Rio Grande to come to the city council meeting this April, what was the date?
22nd.
The 22nd, and express their concern as well for the good of us all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Items not on the agenda tonight.
Good evening. My name is John Pepper. I also live in the Robin Circle area. I moved here from Orange County probably in the 70s to get away from traffic and a lot of people. I found come here, got married, had some small children, enjoyed it a lot, greatly, and then found Robin Circle. Low traffic, no through traffic, perfect for a family. I could leave my children out on the sidewalk and keep an eye out through the window, let them play in the streets a little bit, pull them in when cars come, but there weren't many cars. I had small children then who are now gone. Of course, I'm pretty old, but they have been replaced by grandchildren. who also like to play out. And you can't keep the children off the street all the time. I'm sorry, I'd like to do that, but you can't do it. I would sure hate to have to see this neighborhood changed from what it is to what it may become. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
My name is Jennifer Swift, and I live in Aurora Grande off of James Way, and I'm also concerned about this law that might be passed by the city council. I moved here from Oregon originally to San Luis Obispo and recently moved to Aurora Grande 3 years ago and really enjoy the quiet neighborhood, family type of atmosphere it offers me. And I am single, so I go out and walk my dog. I like the fact that my neighbors know who I am. I know their dogs. It's just a family-oriented kind of thing. And to bring these other kind of people in, and I've seen your oppositions to where it's going to bring more tourism if you've got this beautiful home with a pool, but in putting it up on the internet to just kind of out there, I don't know what kind of people that would attract. And that's what kind of scares me. And again, with pedophiles or people, you know, robbers, that's a perfect opportunity for them to stalk the neighborhood and the children. So I'm totally against it, and I hope that this kind of helps with your decision. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Items not on the agenda. Last call. Going once, going twice. Okay, we're going to close community comments and suggestions. And
on the council's decision to support the by vote the fire authority's tax increase. If I'm wrong in that, I read the minutes, and those comments were not included. That unfortunately opens the door for me to make this observation. Ken Goodman wrote a letter to Tallulah Press, and I won't read the whole letter, but it addresses this issue. And he concludes the right thing for the City Council of Aurora Grande and Grover Beach and the Oceano District would was to do nothing at all, leave it to the true citizen property owners to vote. That's the beauty of Prop 218 that allows the city to vote its properties, and that's another reason, respectfully, Mr. Mayor, I think there are legitimate needs the city has on financing. I think it's time that you come forth with a very broad statement to educate the people in the village in writing of what you're doing, why you're doing, and why you have to do it, because we support you in doing those things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. excuse me. Anyone else who would like to address an item on the consent agenda? Seeing no one else, we will close public comment on the consent agenda. We'll bring this to the council. What is the will of the council? Any items to pull this evening?
I just have a question about the minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Why don't we just pull it? And I was not here, so.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and pull it, because I just read it.
Okay. All right. So any other items to pull? All right, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda, items 8A through 8F, with the exception of 8C.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Anything to read in there tonight, Tim?
Nothing to read, Mayor Varner.
Okay, thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Varnich?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, why don't we pull 8C, Councilmember Brown?
Yeah, I'm requesting that we pull this item until we can review what might should have been added, maybe.
If I can just under comment read it, it's right in here.
Is it?
Yeah, it says consented. Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie invited the public to comment on the consent agenda. Speaking from the public in opposition were Julie Tacker, Otis Page, and April McLaughlin spoke in opposition to item 8H. sufficient local traffic. So I do think it was expressed in there.
Do we need to put any more detail or not? I mean,
it's also under citizens' input, comments, and suggestions. Speaking from the public, we're Otis Page, Myrtle Street, in opposition of the proposed Five Cities Fire Authority Benefit Assessment District.
Go ahead. Oh, just recall that we did a while back go to action minutes, and so it is much more brief and don't provide the description.
I'm ready to move for approval.
All right, there's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
I'm going to abstain. I was not here. Okay, moving on to item 9, public hearings. We do have one this evening. 9A is, I'm sorry, we have two. 9A is consideration of a general plan amendment 14-001 and development code amendment 14-003. This is in relation to land use designation and annexation. And Teresa and Kelly, good evening.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Proposed is a general plan amendment and development code amendment to pre-zone a 48.74-acre property that is currently located in the county for the purpose of annexation. The subject property is located at the end of Castillo del Mar, southeast of the Vista del Mar residential subdivision, and is surrounded by the city limits on three sides. The site has a long history of subdivision submittals that started in 1990. Because of the site's proximity to the city and potential project impacts on traffic and water, the city has been actively involved in the development review process under the county's jurisdiction. As background, there's a long background, but I try to summarize it in just bullet points. In 1990, a mitigated neck for the general public. The 2013 amendment to the agreement was in response to a resubmittal of the Busick tract. The new project, called Heights at Vista Del Mar, adds 6 lots to the original project for a total of 22 lots. The reason why the original tract was not pursued was primarily because of the downturn in the economy. The project was determined pretty much unviable at 16 lots. The MOU was amended to mainly address water supply, which the city has agreed to provide through water retrofit offsets. At the same time that the MOU was amended, the city also approved the initiation of proceedings for amending the city's sphere of influence to include this particular project site. The Local Agency Formation Commission, or LAFCO, formally approved the city's sphere of influence amendment last November. And then the county approved the tract 4038, Heights at Vista Del Mar, last December. To date, the applicant has paid for the water conservation retrofit projects, and these retrofits have either been completed or about to be completed. Based on a technical report conducted by Water Systems Consulting, the project water will be offset by more than 2-to-1 with the retrofit water savings. Now, this slide shows how the subdivision is laid out. The project site has varied terrain, with the northern portion more steeply sloped and containing a sensitive oak woodland. This wooded area is almost 15 acres in size and has been set aside as perpetual open space. Access is from an extension of Castillo del Mar that terminates at a gate into a county residential subdivision. Access through this gate is for emergency access only. A drainage basin is located at the end of the second cul-de-sac, and all common facilities will be maintained by a homeowners association. The staff report includes the county's conditions of approval for the project. These conditions were drafted with city staff input and constructed such that certain conditions would apply if the project were built within the county's jurisdiction or if annexed and built within the city. There are also city conditions that apply regardless of which jurisdiction the property is ultimately in. Annexation of the property is consistent with the policies outlined in the land use and housing elements of the general plan as outlined in the staff report. If LAFCO approves the annexation, the proposed general plan amendment would change the land use designation of the project site from county residential to suburban to city low-density residential. The proposed development code amendment would pre-zone the property to residential hillsides. LAFCO requires that the city pre-zone the property prior to any formal annexation. If approved tonight, staff will prepare the necessary documents for LAFCO's consideration. The advantages of annexing the property into the city include gaining access improvements that will help relieve congestion related to high school traffic, enabling the city to better manage use of the groundwater, and gaining additional impact fee revenue. The main disadvantage would be the additional road maintenance cost within the project boundaries that we don't currently have. If the city does not approve the proposed general plan and zoning amendments, thereby rejecting the annexation request, the city would enter into an outside user agreement for water supply. LAFCO would still need to approve this agreement if we went in that direction. The issue of providing an emergency access in favor of the adjacent Sunrise Terrace Mobile Home Park has recently been brought to staff's attention. As shown in the supplemental memo to council, a revised resolution and ordinance have been drafted to include a finding that states the proposed amendments will not adversely affect the public health, safety, or welfare with the addition of an emergency access easement in favor of Sunrise Terrace Mobile Home Owners Association. Staff met with the president of the association, his name is Denny Novell, at the site last week, and then also met with the project applicant yesterday regarding this emergency access. This particular slide shows the general vicinity of where the easement would occur. The easement would provide a much-needed alternative route for residents of the mobile home park in case of an emergency. And currently, the mobile home park only has access to Valley Road. Sunrise Terrace has a total of 300 homes and about roughly 450 senior residents. In conclusion, it is recommended that Council adopt a mitigated negative declaration, adopt a resolution approving changes to the land use designation of the property.
Run through conservation, is that?
Yes, we have several different projects to do retrofits for irrigation, and studies have shown that we will more than offset 2-to-1 of what the project needs.
And those mitigations haven't been counted for any other project in the city?
No. No, just for this project.
Okay. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
This is a public hearing. If there is anyone in the audience who would like to come forward on this item, this would be your opportunity. 9A. Anyone?
Hi. My name is Kathy McKenna, and I'm here, I guess, with some of my neighbors. My main concern, being short here, the drainage basin that you guys have there borders on my property. My property is the mobile home park is.
Here, would you like a laser pointer?
Oh, I don't know.
Just point on the right thing.
On top, just push and point.
Like this is where the mobile home park is at. And my property, where this bees at, we're right along there. So this is Falcon Ridge Homeowners Association in here. And my property is pretty much right there. So this is the drainage basin, and we submitted some information to the county, lots of information, which I don't have right now. But our concern is in a 100-year flood, that overflows, and it overflows into my property. The mobile home park, how you're having a an emergency access there, I don't know, because that if this was a topo map, well, it kind of is. The mobile home park is 20 feet up. It's the backside of their property is the storage of their fifth wheels, their trailers, their vacation ones, not the mobile homes. So anyway, that's a different story. I'm more concerned about the drainage because it will go right into my yard and flood my entire house. There is an existing culvert pipe that goes from that drainage basin underneath the mobile home park, and it ends up in my backyard. There's never been enough rain for that. Right now it's probably clogged full of mud because it was put in, when was Sunrise Terrace put in? 45 years ago? Okay, 74, yeah. So I remember that. Anyway, so that is my biggest concern, is the drainage, because I definitely don't want all that water ending up in my yard, and you don't want that to happen either. So anyway, I don't know what information you received from the county when you guys, because December meeting is when we presented it. Mark Vasquez had an excellent detail, and I apologize for not having that available, but I can provide that if you'd like. And he had the calculations showing that the county's calculations for that drainage basin were incorrect and not good enough. So anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for your comments. Anyone else on 9A? Come on up. Tony, how are you?
I am fine, as far as my doctor says. I guess this is how does this work? A red button, okay. I am probably the most affected by this.
Tony, can we get your name for the
record, I'm sorry. Please? Yes, my name is Anthony Detweiler, okay? 2780 Coast View Drive, Arroyo Grande. And it's right there. And it's on the upslope looking over. So I have some concerns because I haven't, I wasn't able to read. Maybe they're solved, maybe they're not. My first one, I guess, is that when I look back at the old Track 1789 proposal, and the last, I think, a written thing was in 2008, the 16-lot versus 22-lot. Explain to me. Can you explain to me what the... I mean, other than to make more money, okay, I understand that, okay. Why would it have originally been proposed and approved at 16 and now at 22? Does anybody know that answer?
Well, we'll take your statements, and then when
okay.
we're all done,
all right.
we'll see if we can
that's
hit
fine.
The
So that's,
the,
that's
issues.
That's one item. The second thing is it's hard for me to look at that on a flat map and know what the developer is proposing as far as height setbacks, architectural requirements, et cetera. In other words, we just look at the extreme or the absurd. Obviously, if you have if you don't have restraints development for the city, and I, by the way, I believe that the city that needs to develop that, and I think it's probably very appropriate that you annex it. but you still want it to look. I mean, whoever's proposing this needs to give you the detail so that you don't have to have further conflicts down the line. So I think it's very important to know where on each lot the building envelope, in other words, where can the house be placed, okay? And I think that's very, very common in development. the next thing, just as obviously affects me, this little thing here, there's a gate there. The old proposal, there was some agreement between the Falcon Ridge development and the proposer of how to handle that access. Now, this looks like there's no access. Is that true? Or is there still going to be fire access? We have a gate here. I have the key to that gate. Okay. So I just want to know, somebody's going to cut my lock or what? So anyway, right there. How does this development affect access through and to Falcon Ridge? Um, with the proposal of the 22 lots, all right, and there's 48.74 acres, of which, was it 12, are going to be into the oak, is that right? 15, okay, 15 from 48 is 33, divided by 22 is 1.5, roughly 1.5 acres per lot. Is that what the proposal is? Okay, and is that a, I know the original proposal was like 2.5 acres. Okay, so they're cutting the lot sizes down, probably so they can obviously sell more lots. Is this something that is, you know, is this something that is the, is it okay? All right, in other words, I don't know if you have any ideas of what the lot sizes should be there. It's clearly a big cut, okay? And it obviously means, you know, more a little more condensed, not huge, obviously, so 1.5 to 2 acres, but still, that's, I'm just wondering about and questioning the logic of doing that other than that the developer wants to do 22. Why didn't he do 33, for instance, and have 1 acre minimum? Or why didn't he back off to 16 and have two acre minimum? So, and where does the council, what, how does the city feel about that? Okay. Last thing, and I don't know where this comes from, of course, it's especially a problem now. Hopefully it won't be after this next storm, but where's the water, is the water going to come from City of Arroyo Grande? That's my question. Sewer. Where's the sewer going to come from? Developer has to put it in, or is it going to be septic? Okay. And, of course, who pays for that? Okay. Hopefully, I will not be assessed on my lot for things, improvements to that lot. Obviously, that's a would be a given from my standpoint. So those are the questions I have. The only suggestion I have is that before this approval take place, is these answers to some of these things, which the developer already knows, be further detailed in whatever you have, okay, so that we can look at the whole picture as how it stands. I don't mind, you know, I'm available anytime. I would really like to make more intelligent comments because I don't know without seeing the detail of these things that I'm asking, all right. And I don't know if anybody out here does. And I don't know if you do either, because maybe you guys are seeing some papers I don't see. But anyway, my request would simply be that let's back off, let's get some more detail on this. I think it makes a lot of sense for the city to annex it, but it would be nice that you could exercise the control over that annexation that you should and keep it as a really, you know, keep Arroyo Grande as a really great place to live. So that's my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Hi, I'm Jan Dreyer. I'm the board of Falcon Ridge Association. I was involved in the initial negotiations when this was going to come through Falcon Ridge, and then an agreement was done that we were totally separate. We're county and this is city, and the only concern that I have from a board point of view, from the input that I have, other input I have from my homeowners, is we had very detailed agreement about the emergency exit, including input.
To provide a means of access, that's great. If this is intended to be the specific point of access, we've got a bit of a problem with that because the way I just lay it out roughly, and again, I'd like to see some more detail. This is actually located behind our laundry room, and there's about a 20 or 30 foot drop from Sunrise Terrace Drive down to where that access would be. And we're not in a position to provide engineered fill to make that work going across to the property that's there. We also had a concern about this drainage ditch, but from reading the final environmental impact report, I'm left to assume there's going to be some sort of a dam constructed across the end of this with some sort of a metered release in it that assures us that there's no more flow coming out of that retention basin than there would be in a normal runoff situation. So we're good with that as long as that metered release is maintained by the Homeowners Association, which is what's required in the documents that I've seen. So those are my concerns.
All right. Thank you very much for your comments. Anyone else? Okay. Last chance on 9A. Thank you for not walking off with our pointer. That happens occasionally. So, all right. We're going to close the public hearing portion of 9A. And before we bring this back to the council, we're going to allow the applicant to come forward. And perhaps, Jason, you can comment on some of the issues that have been brought up. So please feel free.
My name is Jason Blankenship, 1867 Costa del Sol, Pismo Beach. Good morning, Honorable Mayor and fellow City Council members. Thank you for taking the time to hear me speak about this project. First and foremost, I wanted to thank the city staff, county staff, and all the different agencies that have worked to get us to where we are today. I've worked with a lot of agencies during my years of entitlement, and this team effort between joint agencies has taken a tremendous amount of work, and your staff has done a tremendous job. Thanks again. This project started over 20 years ago and has been through countless government hearings at multiple levels, an EIR and an EIR addendum. The project before you today proposes 22 single-family lots. Studies and supporting documents have been prepared and updated. All updated letters showed no significant impacts pertaining to traffic, visual, air quality, biological, and drainage. All impacts are addressed and mitigated for by the current project conditions. Requirements for building permit, compliance with current air and water quality standards during post-construction activity would be applicable to this track. The drainage design incorporated into the project meets current requirements for LID and drainage as required by the Regional Quality Control Board. The final drainage design would be dictated and plan checked by the City of Aurora Grande Public Works Department. We are very excited about this project finally moving forward to where breaking ground is finally a reality. The project was to be built in 2008, but with the big recession that hit and the requirement to extend Valley Road, we couldn't make the project pencil. We ask that the City Council approve this project as proposed tonight. In regards to a lot of the questions, I think I'll leave it to Wallace to answer the drainage questions because that's above my pay grade. Secondly, there are height restrictions on some of these lots, so I think that city staff can speak to that. There are building envelopes that are highlighted in the staff report and on the development plan, so that's all been done. So, and as far as CCNRs, we are going to be following the Vista Del Mar 1 project CCNR, so a lot of those concerns will go away. As far as the access, we just really heard about this recently about their request. Well, I did get an email about a month and a half ago about them trying to entertain an access. But we do want to caution council to when you're moving that, it's going to impact our lots and we need to be able to sell them. So we understand there's going to be some cost for them to do the road, but we're offering the access up for free. So I think that's about it. And I can have Wallace come over to answer the drainage questions. Thank you.
Okay, before you leave, we may have a few questions. Are there questions for Jason?
I don't think for Jason. Thank you.
I guess the only question that I have has to do with the some of the last comments with regard to the change in elevation on that access road where it engages Sunrise Terrace. Have we checked that out at all?
At the site yesterday, and if I could borrow the pointer, I can.
It's been hijacked here.
This information we have right now, we're looking at preliminary grading and standing up there looking at existing grades. So it does appear to be very feasible. I think we have some general consensus that it's feasible. Placement along the property line may vary a little bit, and that's why it's shown with a bubbled form. In the described exhibit you have before you this evening.
Okay, and the access gate, I'm with Falcon Ridge, that's going to stay as is?
Yeah, as an emergency only. And all of the conditions transferred over to answer her question. So, I mean, bottom line, it's going to stay as approved, and that's going to be emergency only.
Okay. And the drainage issue, there was comments about the 100-year flood. How is it going to proceed? So our Public Works is going to work through, regional water quality is going to have a play in that as well?
Yes, the environmental review that's been conducted previously and again with the revised project description reviewed some preliminary drainage information. There's conditions of approval that need to be satisfied as the applicant comes forward with their improvement plans, additional drainage studies to verify that all requirements can be met. And that would be done, presuming the annexation goes through, will be done through the city's departments and in conjunction with city and state requirements.
Okay. This is going to tie into South County sanitation?
That's correct.
Okay. For sewer. All right. Anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll bring this to the council then, and we'll start with Council Member Costello.
Well, this has been going on for quite a while, and the main thrust has been trying to resolve the traffic flow and get things going. Tonight, we're just looking at the land use designation. It's not necessarily coming out with a completed project with approvals. And at this point, I'm willing to go forward with the changes in designation with the expectation that anything else specific to the project will come before us at a later time. Or am I jumping the gun on that?
If I can briefly respond to that, excuse me. The subdivision map was approved by the county about 3 months ago. We're not here to look at the subdivision itself because we have no control over it. It's been approved. The vesting map has been entitled. So you're really limited at looking at the issue of annexing the property, its pre-zoning, and its general plan designation.
Well, that being said, we don't really have a whole lot of control over this. I think that, in my mind, annexing this property makes a lot of sense in bringing it into the city. It's going to happen either way, so I think that I will support this tonight.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to reiterate, it seems that as though, despite the fact that this has been entitled by the county, it's still somewhat of a work in progress in terms of the actual technical issues of drainage and anything else. If a problem were to come up, it would be addressed before it ultimately went forward. That's my understanding.
When the project, revised project, came forward to the county, just for informational purposes, the staff met with county staff. We looked through all the environmental documents, the conditions of approval. The city requested inclusion of several additional conditions of approval, which were incorporated into the project at the county during the county approval process. So we felt that we did add in some provisions to make sure that the project would adhere to city regulations. I could go, hit a couple brief questions that I think most of them have been covered. Certainly, conditions of approval for drainage have been included. CCNR requirements are also included. City will review those and then approve those for the HOA. As Jason stated, the emergency access gate, as originally proposed to Falcon Ridge, is not changed. We did review the city's proposed zoning before you this evening and general plan requirements for this project as it was going through county approval to see and make sure that it met city requirements and it fits in within the zoning allowed by the city. And
now I'm more than ready to move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Let you know, in the May, the first meeting in May, we'll be coming forward to the council with a whole summary of a comprehensive strategies regarding water supply. But to let you know, those are primarily based around conservation strategies that probably will be our main strategy moving forward. But we'll be bringing that forward, and it'll be a comprehensive report for you to consider.
Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. There was a woman that spoke, and I wanted to know her address because it makes a difference. And can I?
Who was that?
It was the lady in the green jacket.
Tina Keller?
Oh, yeah. Could you just tell me your what street you live on? Because I wasn't clear on that. Okay. So is that in, that's not in Falcon Ridge?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay. Okay.
We can't hear you back here, and so you can't make comments unless you're willing to come back to the podium and pretty much close the public comment. So.
Okay. I think it makes a lot of sense to annex this into the city for the reasons that have been mentioned. I'm a little uncomfortable. I wasn't on the city council when this came before us before. I'm just a little uncomfortable with Mr. Detweiler not having some of his questions answered. I'm not sure why you don't know some of the things that you were asking as far as the building heights and the setbacks. I think those are valid questions. But I think this is the end of the road. I think this has all gone through the county, the planning, county planning commission, and there's been public hearings. I'm willing to go along with the will of the council, but I hope that those questions can be answered. And I don't know, Teresa, if you want to elaborate on that or Kelly.
I just wanted to mention that there is a requirement under the special conditions that you have in your packet, city condition number 9, that states that they must have approved design guidelines that will go through the Architectural Review Committee, which is a public forum. So there is opportunity for people to be aware of that, and if they wanted to get on the mailing list, they just need to contact the city.
Oh, okay. So I thought I had asked that of somebody earlier today, that would this go before the ARC, and I thought it wouldn't. So that makes me feel a lot more comfortable. If it will come before the city ARC, Architecture Review Committee. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so...
Well, specifically the design guideline document would be applicable for the homes that would be constructed there.
Right, right.
Similar to the Grace Lane process? The design guidelines are approved, and then each individual property owner comes in for a design review, and that goes to ARC.
Okay. So I think I'm ready to move forward tonight.
All right. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
I think as some of you know, I was the one holdout on this, and that was specifically on the water issue, I don't think that that in fact these lots will come in at the water use that was presented, and in fact does add to our water debt as mentioned by Councilmember Brown. But when we look at what we're doing tonight, I mean clearly annexation is far superior to an outside water user agreement. It gives us control rather than hoping that the county in fact exercises some sort of control. So this is a for the city, and particularly for my specific concern, our action tonight is an easy one for me because annexation is superior to the alternative. But doesn't change my basic opinion that in fact we're going to come out behind on the water on this deal. But I'm certainly prepared to support this evening. And I am glad to hear that it is going to architectural review. I was just trying to find somewhere what the design was and what the county's design is pretty basic. But I am glad I did miss the part where it's going to come to architectural review. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Teresa, I want to come back to that comment you made a second ago. So even though there are CC&Rs, and there, I'm assuming, I don't know if it'll be a separate HOA or if it'll be part of Vista Del Mar. Will they join Vista Del Mar or separate HOA? Separate? Okay, so, but the CCNR is a compatibility with the surrounding development. Those are all things that the ARC will review, I'm sure. Is that correct?
Yes, as far as the design guidelines, in fact, I believe a lot of it will be based on the Vista Del Mar neighborhood. There will be other provisions for.
And I may be a little more comfortable with what's happened with those water offsets, because I know we've already retrofitted the cemetery. And for those of you who are not aware of it, the Arroyo Grande Cemetery was an incredibly intense water use location. And now with the retrofit, they're saving a ton of water. And we're also retrofitting Lucia Mar School District's sites, and those were sorely in need of it as well. And then another big user has always been Rancho Grande Park. That park will be retrofitted as well. So those are substantial conservation offsets, substantial. And so I'm not going to, I'm not going to look upon that as just a paper source. Those are actual water savings. So a little more comfortable with that. What's in front of us tonight with regard to the annexation and the land use designation and so on and so forth, I have been with this project for a long time, and I have seen it change. But it's changed within the scope of our general plan and within the approved guidelines for the city, and I'm assuming the county. And I also want to make just a quick mention of the relationship that we have with county planning now. It has greatly improved, and so we expect that that relationship will continue, and that the county will continue to be mindful of our concerns and address those in whatever conditions are ultimately placed on projects. So I'm comfortable, much more comfortable these days with that relationship that we have. So I'm prepared to move forward as well. And so our recommendation is adopting a resolution for the changes to the land use designation, and then we also have an ordinance to introduce. So who would like to try a motion?
Mr. Mayor, I'll make a motion that we adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande approving General Plan Amendment 14-001, amending the land use map for property adjoining the city in the vicinity of Castillo del Mar, APN number 075-021-026. For the purpose of annexation, the applicant is the Heights at Vista Del Mar Group, LLC.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Discussion?
Just a clarification, Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
Page 2 is being replaced in the supplemental. Has a different finding regarding the emergency access issue. And if you can include in the actual motion itself adoption of the mitigated neg deck, that would also be appreciated by staff.
In this motion or the next motion?
Well, in this motion.
Well, I'll include the adoption of the neg deck.
And you need the amendment on
just clarification that you're going to be utilizing the page 2 that's in the supplemental for both the ordinance and the resolution.
And we will be using
Was the title amended?
No.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. All right. So language consistent with the supplemental?
Absolutely. The language consistent with the supplemental.
All right. Second hold?
Second hold.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
And, Mr. Mayor, I move an ordinance to the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande pre-zoning a 48.74-acre property adjoining the city in the vicinity of the Castillo del Mar, APN 075-021-026. For the purpose of annexation, Development Code Amendment 14-003, the applicant is the Heights at Vista Del Mar Group with the amended language on page 2.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Discussion on this one? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for your comments. How's everybody doing? Still okay?
Maybe after this one.
Okay, we're going to move on to our second public hearing, 9B. This is a resolution adjusting the master fee schedule. Deborah, good evening.
Good evening, Mayor, members of council. I'm Debbie Malicote, your administrative services director. I'm here tonight to talk about amending the master fee schedule. I don't have a PowerPoint. For the most part, these are the annual changes that we make based on the change to the consumers and $300 in additional revenues. And the fees would be effective on July 1st. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. Questions on the staff report for Deborah?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Deborah, on the non-resident fee that we're keeping for softball, I think that's the only one we're keeping, the non-resident fee. Is that correct?
We're currently reviewing the non-resident fee. Okay. We do charge that for adult softball. And some classes have a non-resident fee component as well, and so we're looking at that. We're going to be doing some analysis about how, you know, our usage, how much of our usage is based on residents, non-residents, the income that's generated from that, the additional costs that are associated with it. So we'll be coming back to you in the near future with some recommendations if there are any to make changes to non-resident fees related to recreation programs.
Okay, so as it stands right now, it's the one that we're eliminating is the child care only.
Right, and that's really based more on the administrative burden of that fee. We have increasingly children that participate in the program whose parents are separated, divorced. Mom lives in Aurora Grande, dad lives in Pismo Beach. Do we charge it? Do we not charge it? It's whose week is it for custody of the child? So it becomes really burdensome, and we really don't have that many that are affected by it. We're estimating it's a few hundred dollars a year, and the staff cost of administering that seems to outweigh the benefit that we would get from the resident non-resident fee.
Okay. And then my only other question is on the annual encroachment permit fee. Now, that's going up quite a bit. It's $250 now. It's going up to $5,750. Now, maybe I'm thinking about this incorrectly, but encroachment fee only for utility companies? Don't people get encroachment fees for doing maybe tree trimming or I'm not sure what else? So is that everyone's going to pay that encroachment fee, or is it just utility companies?
We basically will have two encroachment permits. One would be sort of a one-time use.
Okay.
For example, your tree trimming.
Okay.
The other would be what I would say unlimited use for the utility companies, where they come in and they do a lot of work throughout the city. They're still going to be required to notify us, and we're still going to inspect the work that they do. And there's a lot that will go into that annual fee that the utility companies pay. But it's really going to be based on them utilizing the services many, many times throughout the year, as opposed to that one-time user that will pay the $250.
Okay. And so now when the utility companies come in, they were paying the fee, and they were coming in multiple times all during the year, and they weren't really notifying the city when they were doing work, so it wasn't really didn't have much oversight, and now it's going to have much more oversight. And then this sort of equates with the staff time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And how is the $5,750, how does that compare to other cities? Is that pretty comparable for that oversight?
We did look at that, and the other city in the county that has such a fee is the city of San Luis Obispo, and their fee is about $8,000. You know, they are a larger city and have more activity with the utility companies, but we certainly looked at that. One of the things that I would like to mention is we base the fee on some limited data on usage, and so we will be able to monitor that much more closely now, and we'll be able to recommend changes to that fee annually as we review and get better and better data about the actual usage that's happening. But because we didn't always know that the utility companies were coming into our city to do work, it was hard to track how many instances of right-of-way encroachment there had been.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Okay. Did you have a question? I had just one question. Deborah, is it fairly common practice for cities these days to use the CPI?
That's what I'm most familiar with. That's what I see out there. There are other indices that people use. Even in our city, we use the Engineering News Record Index for construction costs. When we look at our development impact fees, that's the mechanism that we use. But CPI is very commonly used throughout the state to adjust fees.
As opposed to doing annual studies.
As opposed to an annual study, which is very time-consuming and expensive.
Okay.
It's still prudent to do a study every so often to make sure that your fees haven't gotten, you know, out of whack. That's a highly technical finance term, out of whack. But it's very expensive to undertake that, and so you want to do it every 5-6 years just to sort of recalibrate your fees and adjust
so
the CPI industry standard on how often you go back and check your fee study.
All right. This is not a public hearing, but we do invite members of the public to come forward on items such as these. Anyone who would like to come forward? Okay. Seeing no one, we will close public comment on this item. I'm sorry, this is a public hearing. I'm still on East Coast time here, folks. All right, so we'll bring this to the council. We'll start on the other end. Councilmember Barnich.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I am ready to move ahead with this evening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Councilmember Braun.
As am I.
All right, and Councilmember Costello.
Well, to celebrate the rain that's happening right now, I'll go along with this tonight, too.
Is it raining?
So exciting.
Serious? Is it raining out there?
There's some rain.
Oh, good. That's good news.
I will support this. I will support this tonight.
Okay. Wonderful. Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, I'll support it as well.
Okay. And I think with the other understanding that next time around we'll do a more in-depth discussion on this kind of the cycle when we do this, and I'll support this as well, and I'm ready to entertain a motion here.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move a resolution of the City of Arroyo Grande adjusting certain operating fees set forth in the master fee schedule.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, looking at the clock, and council is going to take a 5-minute necessity break, and we'll be back soon. Council is back in session, and we are going to move along in the agenda. And the next item is 10A, and this is consideration to include a revised alternative in the project approval and environmental determination. This is the report and amendment to consultant services agreement for Wood Rogers and Point C, and an update on the Briscoe Halcyon 101 project. Teresa?
Good evening again, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Yes, tonight we have a status report for the Briscoe Interchange project, as well as a request for amendments to some consultant services contracts. And this is in order to proceed with design work in conjunction with completing the project approval and environmental determination phase of the project. Your staff report outlines the long and sordid history of the project. Recently, staff and consultants had met with Caltrans in December, and we went over remaining issues of concern that Caltrans had with required design exceptions for alternative 4. The result of the meeting was identification of a modified alternative 4C. And it was concluded that some additional information regarding those alternatives including some design speeds on West Branch and some other intersection treatments, was needed in order to finalize feasibility. Very importantly, the additional time and effort is required to move the project through the environmental phase in an expedited manner. This is needed to secure the project's schedule and secure project funding. An additional $1 million was recently recommended by SLOCOG to the California Transportation Commission for the construction phases of the project, which increases the total grant funding to $6.6 million. Staff has met briefly with county staff and elected officials, Rodeos Drive residents, St. Patrick's School representatives, and some neighborhood representatives for just to touch base on the project status. The environmental review process, which we are trying to complete, will provide a lot of additional noticing and additional information that will better inform us and Caltrans on a preferred option. I have Tony Harris here from Point C, and he has been with the project here for a while now, very familiar, and he's going to walk you through the modified alternative and explain those a little further. Tony?
Thank you, Teresa. Mayor, Council Member, it's a pleasure to be with you again to talk about this project, and I am looking forward to coming back to the groundbreaking ceremony one day. But I would just briefly walk you through a very brief PowerPoint to explain the alternatives, where we are, the next steps, and the timing that's necessary for the project. What you're looking at here is West Branch would have a design speed of 35 miles an hour. The other thing that was important is the alignment of these ramps. It was very important in discussion with Caltrans to try to get the intersection as close as possible to have a 90-degree angle to help improve stop and site distance from a safety perspective. The other thing that you'll see elements of this project is there are impacts on county's facility and also the regional facility because of the realignment of West Branch. The concept would also include the inclusion of a park and ride lot adjacent to St. Patrick's School in particular. A lot of discussion went in with Caltrans to actually move forward with this, but as part of that discussion with Caltrans, one of the things that they wanted to see us update and include as part of the environmental document is what they label as an alternative intersection treatment. So really it's not a new alternative that will go along with this, but what they would like for us to do is also evaluate the possibility of, instead of having a traffic single, a roundabout at this location. That requires us to do additional engineering analysis. It also requires us to update our technical studies. There is a possibility that a roundabout would have less design exceptions, but until that analysis is done and we can update our technical studies, we cannot clearly explain that to you in particular. There are several features that are common with the alternative 4C, whether it's a hook ramp with traffic singles or a roundabout that goes along with the project. Although it's not shown on this drawing, it will still have the park and ride lot here in particular. There would be a realignment of West Branch, but because of a roundabout, we're able to use sharper curves. And we will have to do additional engineering analysis to fully evaluate what level impact there are to the county facility. It's envisioned there may be less in this area, but that will be part of the effort that the consultant team will be working on. What I want to emphasize in the next couple of slides is features that are common to alternative 4, regardless of whether or not it's a hook ramp or the alternative intersection treatment. At Grand Avenue, you have the offset now of the off-ramp versus the on-ramp. The project would include the actual alignment of these ramps so you don't have a spread-out intersection. This would basically be cleared as part of the environmental document, but is viewed as a later phase of construction as funding becomes availability. It's not really an operational improvement. It's more about alignment, making the traffic signal operate more appropriately. This feature is included with Alternative 4 as well. This is existing Rodale Drive. This is Grace Lane. And one of the features after discussions with the community is we would basically realign this intersection. Instead of having it be a straight through for Rodale Drive, it will have a straight through curve created for Grace Lane.
as a way to minimize traffic through the community in particular. That's a feature that's common for the Alternative 4, and that has been discussed with the different stakeholders in particular. What's most important of what we're trying to accomplish, and Teresa mentioned this a little bit earlier, is in the process back in 2012, we was able to work with the San Luis Obispo Council of Government and work with them to convince the California Transportation Commission to provide $5.6 billion for construction for the project. Those funds are programmed and available in the state's fiscal year 2016-2017. Teresa mentioned earlier that SLOCOG has also recommended an additional $1 million. The California Transportation Commission approved that last week. So the total amount of state funding that's available for the project is $6.6 million available in fiscal year 2016-2017. What's important for us to do now is move forward through the environmental project approval process in an expeditious manner to get the input so that a decision could be made on the selection of what is built so we can move forward and have that money allocated for construction within that time period. This slide demonstrates to you is the steps that we need to undertake. We need to update the environmental technical studies. Several of them was completed previously, but with the changes that was talked about in alternative 4C and also the alternative intersection treatment, that work needs to be brought up to speed as the previous work and updated and included in environmental technical studies. Once we do that, we can update the draft environmental document. And our goal is to get to a public circulation of the draft environmental document in early fall of this year. We was able to accomplish with Caltrans back in 2011, I think it was, where they actually delegated lead agency status for the project to the city, which was a major accomplishment and allowing us to move forward with it. With that, we will circulate the document, we'll do the public circulation, we'll collect the comments, make the appropriate revisions, make the selection of what's the bill alternative, with the goal of being able to complete the environmental document process by the end of this calendar year, early 2015, depending upon the comments and input that we received during that process. We would need to move immediately towards design with the goal of being able to have it ready to advertise for construction within.
Since we've been on the council, and I first became involved in this in 1996, and this has been ongoing ever since the council at the time determined that the shopping center up on West Branch would be a regional shopping center and not what it was zoned for originally, which was a community shopping center. I'm not saying that that's a bad idea, but what we're dealing with now and have been dealing for decades is the fact that our circulation system was not set up to handle it. And so this has been a lingering issue for us. It has been back and forth with Caltrans so many times, I have lost count. The best thing we could have done was bring Tony Harris aboard. Tony has advanced this thing farther than we thought we were ever going to get. We're on the brink of moving this thing forward. The roundabout that you saw on the slide was not our idea. It was Caltrans' idea, and they actually drew up the first concept drawing on it. And when they go that far, they expect us to study it, and, of course, they expect us to pay for that study. So that's the way it works. But as Tony just mentioned, there are additional project costs associated with some of the encroachment onto the county property. We had a good conversation with the county. They're open to working with us. And the nice thing is, as he mentioned, was SLOCOG just put out the media release that the California Transportation Commission approved the additional funding for our project. So that is very, very good news. So I just wanted to kind of tag on to the staff report with that. So let's start at the other end with Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I've been involved in this one for a long time myself. I've been part of the subcommittee, and I've seen a lot of the information we saw tonight before. This has been quite an endeavor working with Caltrans to get where we are, and I'll fully support going forward with everything tonight.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, Tony, thanks for making the trek. Maybe I need to turn my mic on. Thanks for making the trek. The fact that we get anything moved along with Caltrans is somewhat of a miracle, so
take some pride in what you're doing. I think it's really great. I've watched the passion of the mayor on this project since it started, and I remember when it started, and I thought 20 or 30 years was nothing I was ever going to see actually happen, and oh, lo and behold, we're almost there. I have a lot less hair. But with that, I'm more than willing to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Barnich?
I'm ready to move forward as well.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, I too am ready to move forward. Certainly this is just another lap around the pool to try to get this done. So,
so lap around the roundabout. So, okay. All right. Well, I'll certainly make it unanimous. And once again, Tony, thanks for joining us this evening. I know you had a trek down from Sacramento, so appreciate you being here. And
thanks for bringing the rain.
Yeah. All right. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move the council approve the inclusion of the revised alternative 4C with the alternate intersection treatment along with the alternative 1 for the Briscoe Road, Halcyon Road, Highway 101 Interchange Improvement Project approval and environmental determination report, as well as amendment number 10 to the consultant agreement, consultant services agreement with Wood Rogers Incorporation for additional design work for the PA&ED for the Briscoe Road, Halcyon Road, Highway 101 Interchange Improvement Project in the amount of $285,301 and for an extension to February 28, 2015. And thirdly, approve the amendment to the consultant services agreement with Point C LLC for an extension for an additional year for an amount not to exceed amount of $72,000.
All right. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Discussion?
You want to add anything else to that motion, Joe?
No, I think I'm done.
Okay. Any other discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnich?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to 10B. This is a consideration to reject the bids for the police station upgrade project.
Yes, good evening again, Mr. Mayor and council members. On November 26, 2013, the council approved the design for the police station upgrade project, a funding plan, and an amendment for consultant services with the IBI group. Since that time, the architect has completed construction drawings, the police department has moved to the Women's Center, and the project was advertised, the roofing and fencing specifications, some design related to the site radio tower, and some minor clarifications to some items related to the storage. With that, I know Steve wanted to add in some comments. And no, I didn't. The project costs, with including the construction bid, are as follows. We had asbestos removal costs at $51,000. The bid, of course, we covered with the contingency of $179,000 and construction management of $35,000. FF&Es are at $100,000. And then some costs associated with dispatch relocation, a couple thousand there, and earth systems work for soils reports. The total is $2.17 million. This budget shortfall is approximately $840,000. It is recommended to redesign portions of the project to target those items that I pointed out by a minimum of $225,000. Approximately $300,000 can be recommended to be funded out of savings from the police department's existing operational budget, and therefore we would need an additional appropriation of $315,000.
Thank you, Teresa. I just wanted to add just a few comments onto that, given what I know are some of the concerns of the City Council on this item. First of all, to say that the staff is extremely disappointed with the outcome of these bids and this bid process, would be a huge understatement at this point, particularly given all the work that's gone into this project and all the history of this project. We regret very much the position it's put the council in, because we know how supportive you have been in trying to address the needs of the police department and the police station, and how diligent you have been in trying to accomplish this in the most cost-effective manner, which of course is goals, staff's goals also. At this point, you know, we regret that we really aren't at the point yet to be able to provide any kind of definitive answer on why the bids are so far from the bid estimate. It appears to be kind of a perfect storm of a number of things, including increasing cost of construction at this time. There were some items that turned out to be a little more complex than was originally anticipated, like electrical and data. There was a couple items where the architect's bid specifications that were provided, we felt were provided items at a level above what was necessary, and those are the items that are identified in the staff report that we will be rectifying in the rebid. And then lastly, just can't get around the fact that we just had bad bid estimates, and I know the architect is working very hard to determine how that occurred and what areas caused that, but has not been able to come up with a real definitive answer yet. I think we can say that we have been pleased overall with the design work provided by the architect, so that's been good. The only problem we have had is in the estimate. Now, we have been negotiating with the architect, and they have agreed to provide assistance and participation with us in helping to resolve the situation so we can move forward. So they are going to be providing the redesign work at no charge to the city, and they've also agreed to provide additional construction management services to the city at no charge so that we can really manage this construction phase tightly and try to hopefully minimize any additional cost increases in that phase. The Council Member Brown in particular expressed to me the importance of transparency in these types of situations, and I wanted to emphasize how important that is to staff too. That is why we have this item on the continued business items this evening instead of the consent, which normally we put any kind of bid actions, but we wanted to make sure it was discussed and we were transparent in terms of the situation. As far as staff's concerned, I think by now you know me and you know that I'm usually the first to admit if there's mistakes on staff's part. In this instance, I have been monitoring this project very closely, and I feel very strongly that Teresa's been managing this project very effectively and coordinating this project very effectively and review of whether we would have decided something different based on if we would have done the relocation differently. We also did a lot of analysis or at least review on whether we would have developed different recommendations if we would have had better cost data earlier on in the process. But ultimately, we came to the same conclusion because really the same basis that we based those decisions and recommendations on at that time still exist. Even though it's certainly very painful to all of us to have to incur an additional cost, but the reality is if we go back, we've always been very upfront that we felt that building a new station would best meet the long-term needs of the community if we could get a bond measure passed to cover the financing costs. And we worked very hard to try to do that, and unfortunately, under the laws of California, we just could not accomplish the level of public support that was necessary to get that done. And so then we recommended the remodel because given competing needs and the uncertainty of the economy, the objective of going with a remodel is that we wanted to keep from having to issue debt for the city. And the recommended funding plan that Teresa has outlined still does that. And so at this point, we stand by our recommendation, and we urge council to approve that recommendation so we can move forward and get this project done. So we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Steve, is, you know, thank you for providing that additional information, because that was going to be my first question. We don't often miss the mark, and we certainly don't often miss the mark by this much. So I'm appreciative that the background, at least some of the background information, was provided. Still a bitter pill. So questions for Steve? Councilmember Costello, and then Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Steve, faced with the reality that we're going to have to delay this a bit, how much of a delay are we talking about if we rebid and come up with some bids that we find more appealing?
We anticipate a likely two-month delay.
What does this do to the relocation of the women's club functions?
Well, it'll extend, obviously, the time that the police will need that facility, and that will impact the groups that we're planning to be able to move back in at the end of the year. Staff is working with, contacting those groups and making sure provisions are made so that they can use remain in their facilities or find additional facilities for their use.
And we'll continue to help in that process?
Yes.
Okay. And then a second question. And back when we originally talked about redoing this building, I think we were looking at 5 years service for the building. And I at that time said, well, I'd like to see it be closer to 10. And I guess now maybe I'm looking at maybe closer to 15. But if we do extend the life of this building out to about 15 additional years, is there any way to capitalize on that extended life in terms of some sort of cost savings, maybe not this year, but in the future, to help offset the additional costs we're going to spend now?
Well, there's always ways to finance things, and that's fortunately what we've been wanting to avoid. I think we have had that discussion that we are now targeting this facility as something that needs to meet.
I didn't mean necessarily financing solutions, but will there be any operational things that we can do over the next 10 to 15 years maintaining that building that will allow us to save a little money?
Well, part of the upgrade includes a substantial amount of technology upgrades, electrical systems and data systems, and the trend is going to be for our reliance on those systems. The remodel concept, while it's not a large remodel in square footage, does include those substantial technology-related upgrades that should serve the department for that time period.
Yeah, one thing I'd recommend then, if we do indeed reject these bids and we go forward with the strategy to rebid this and try to find little places here and there to save on the project, is that we look at this as a 15-year home and plan for that and try to capitalize on that rather than looking at this as a temporary solution until we can build a new facility. Maybe look at this as a...
It is probably how I feel. But the question I specifically have is, what is the total amount of cost increases that we've incurred so far? Because this is our second round. We did a first round, and now this is our second round.
Total amount of cost increases, I'm not sure what you meant the first round. I think we had some previous design estimates, and we were looking.
We approved additional money. We approved additional items when we did the contract with the consultant. And in fact, I was the only one, I think, on the council that voted no. And that's what I'm asking about, is those increases connected with. And I think Councilman Guthrie and I figured out what the percentage was, and I just don't remember My memory's not as good as it used to be.
So aside from the bid estimate, we incurred $50,000 in asbestos removal costs. We have additional, I ran through these pretty quickly, it's probably totaling about 500.
That's before the bid.
Are you referring to the a few months ago when we came forward with some changes?
We came forward with some changes, and we had to approve some construction management increases and things that we didn't originally anticipate in the budget.
My recollection, they were around 500,000, but I don't have the exact figure. I don't know.
So if they were around 500,000 and now the bid is over by 700,000, we're over by 1.2 at this point. Is that correct?
That's to our recollection. That's correct.
Excuse me a minute, Mr. Mayor.
The only thing we'd like to clarify on that first round, those were all very specific items that were added and that were upgrades to the facility. So, it was an increase in cost, but they were enhancements to the facility that we all made a conscious decision that those were things we wanted to include. This round is a little bit more discouraging because it's just based on an estimate. We're not really getting much more out of it. It was just an estimate that was inaccurate. So.
And at some point, I'm going to ask you, and I think you said you're going to get down to it, I want to hear from the consultant very specifically how he can do this on a daily basis for other projects and be off at this magnitude. That's a huge issue for me, and it puts me in a very uncomfortable position because this entire council is fiscally conservative, and we're left having to do things that we're probably all very uncomfortable with. So at some point, I want to hear from the actual consultant on that issue. I don't. What else was I going to ask about? How do we know, moving forward, given our history with this project and this consultant, that any cost savings and cost overruns aren't going to just continue? I mean, we think we have these cost savings, but we could continue to have cost overruns and be at 1.5, 2 million. We could be way off. How do we know, given our track record with this consultant and this project, that we have any comfort level going forward that we're finally in the ballpark?
Well, we are narrowed down on construction costs primarily right now. We have had discussions with some contractors. We are looking at different value engineering options, and I think through that process we can get a good gauge of certainly where the certain costs that were compiled for these construction bids went above our expectations. And I think that's probably the most important exercise right now. The architect is working with contractors. We've been informed just by some of the contractors involved as to their thoughts. So I think and they're very consistent. So I think we at this point shouldn't expect huge surprises like we have when we just set it out to bid without receiving and opening the bids and investigating and through discussions and what were the issues that the contractors were faced when they were placing their bids.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Steve, you mentioned in the staff report 210
parking lot. And that's where we identified, certainly a bite of the savings projected.
And then I should have asked you this before the meeting, I apologize, but do you know the cost of the roof as it is now? And you can look that up and get back to me.
Well, the bids that came in are pretty much lumped together and not itemized out. But the roofing that was specified appears to be like a proprietary roofing. 15-year roof was identified that, and it was identified that there's many options available. Maybe with a 10-year lifespan roof that would gain even additional savings, but there are several options available for roofing specifications to be modified, and there's some comfort level there in those savings.
So these maybe aren't split down the middle, but we're talking about maybe $105,000 savings in the roof, or?
We're looking at probably, yeah, 100 and I think we projected 110,000 in roofing.
Okay, I don't think I have any other questions right now. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I actually had asked similar questions about the same. I'd asked similar questions about the same. I think I got 120 and 80,000, 80,000 for the fence and 120,000 on the roof. But I may be remembering it wrong. I guess my question, or maybe this goes to the consultant. I mean, am I right? It's about 6,000 square foot building.
It ends up being, with the addition, a little closer to about 10,000.
10,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm struck here is that we have 100. You know, is this a 50% savings? Is it? I mean, I've put on a few roofs, so at a hotel that are more than 10,000 square feet, and we didn't spend 120,000 total.
Yeah, I mean, it was. You know, I stand before you. It was an odd. I mean, we polled several contractors, in coming up with some of the estimates and. You know, inadvertently, I think some of the items in the spec made it proprietary, and it was kind of amazing to me because the estimate, we'd used a similar product on a local roof, and it wasn't near this cost per square. So it was fairly amazing to me to find out that this is what that was. So I think the idea would be to take it back to a different roof type and look at something and making sure that we're completely non-proprietary, allowing the contractors the most amount of competition available, and it was a pretty consistent report from several of the contractors that I talked to. Some that bid the project, and one or two that dropped out because they were too busy.
Do you remember what the percentage here? I mean, is this half the cost?
It's probably about half the cost.
Okay,
anywhere between 60% of the cost to half the cost of what we were told. In terms of the cost of the roof.
And then to go back to the fence, if I remember right, the real difference in the fence here has to do with the visibility that you couldn't see in through the other fence, even though it had, you know, had small holes in it, I'll call it, that we were, in fact, were trying to shield. I'm looking at the chief as well, but that we were trying to shield so that you couldn't see into the parking lot was part of what we were trying to accomplish, and that's actually what we're giving up here for $80,000.
No, not necessarily. And again, I think we have to do a little bit more study on the fence. The main difference in the fence right now is basically going to a little lesser of a security product. So essentially, if I can tell you, it's 50% of the cost is in the material itself. It's going from a heavier gauge metal. They will look almost identical in terms of the way they present themselves to the community. What we were kind of hearing is that there may be some potential that there was in what we were talking about in terms of the screening material, in one sense we had attempted to make it a standard product that the fencing manufacturer makes, and there may have been some discourse in terms of this was an aftermarket or a different type of product, so which would have been a custom product versus wanting everything off the shelf. So essentially those two items together coupled with, and so we will look at the either developing alternatives. So I think some of the things that we will do, I think to answer Mr. Brown's questions, because I think he wanted me to directly to talk about the assurances. And I'm well aware that I stood before you several months ago telling you that I was sure of the price. And in large part, I still am. I'm still trying to figure out some of the things, because some of the things that affect bids
doing it through a change order at this point. And so that we could save the 2 months, we could accept the bid, go in and say, hey, we're going to change these two things, you know, in what I'll call a reverse change order, because like I say, I've almost never seen them change order down, but that would be what we'd be trying to accomplish. What would be our risks in doing that?
Well, I think from my standpoint, I think it's more of a legal question, and it depends on the percentage of the bid. The public contract code typically dictates that if you have a change, it's designed in order for you not to make changes after the fact. I think it was ultimately designed many years ago so that you couldn't add construction costs to a project and enhance a contractor. I don't think these particular situations were necessarily contemplated, but I think it's more of a legal question than it is of whether it's something that we can do in terms of related to the public contract code.
to the city attorney at some point, but I do appreciate that because, like I said, in my business, we have actually change order down and gone, oh, we can't afford that, and just but we weren't in the same kind of contract process.
So we talked about that as one of the strategies moving forward is bringing in an additional contractor to look at other value engineering ideas to help us through this process, and it's something I think we'll continue to discuss. But I think. I will leave no stone unturned in helping you get to a police facility.
I have a couple of questions.
I have one more, Dennis.
You have one more?
Yeah, okay. And it has to do with the timing, then. So you're looking at the review time before you're going to resubmit the RFP as, 30 days, if I'm remembering right, from the 30 days from now that you would be ready to resubmit the RFP.
Right, and it will depend on working to gain a real comfort level ready to go to, so that we're ready to go out to bid, and the time period that we want to have those have it out to bid. So that's a good 3 to 4 week period we'd have it out to bid. Right there. So we're looking at a few weeks to get us ready to bid, getting those questions answered, and then the bid period, and then that's pretty much would put us right at bid opening where we wanted to be in mid-March. We're likely going to be in mid-May.
I think it feels a little optimistic, but, if you're... And then I'll just go ahead and if I can ask him, is that your interpretation as well, that under the code we couldn't do a $210,000 negative change order?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
I guess the thing that, while you're still there, and you touched on it, I guess I'm looking for perhaps a higher comfort level. And what I'm looking at the fix here, where we go from here. And I'm going to have a question for the chief here in a moment. So we go through this process, and without being able to determine what caused the gap between our projected estimates and the actual bids. I'm just a little uneasy if we go back out to bid, what's going to happen. And what I didn't hear mentioned is looking back at a point in time when we were formulating how we were going to approach this, it seemed that there were a lot of contractors looking for work. That's changed now with, I think, the economy improving. I'm convinced that probably that had a little bit to do with it, but... with the activity level in the construction trades continuing to increase, what happens if we go out to bid and even with the redesign and it in fact looks even more unfavorable? I mean, I guess it's the fear of the unknown, and I was hoping you might be able to fill in the gaps here a little bit.
Well, I guess the hard part standing here is that bidding is not an exact science. I don't really know, what the cost of copper wire is going to be today versus tomorrow. But I think time is our ally. So in general, I think we had a fairly good bid spread. We had ten bidders on this project, which is still showing signs that there are a fair amount of bidders that are out there and want to do this project. The bid spread was very tight for 10 bids. So to me, the information that we're getting from the contractors and from the community
levels. Can you elaborate on what's going to happen when you lose that $300K?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think first and foremost, that I think you all know that we operate as lean as we possibly can in the police department. So we're in a good position to look at what we're doing and how we're going to continue to operate even without the $300,000. In this case, it happens to be to our favor that we had vacancies where people had left the department and gone to other police departments, and because of the time period that it takes to both recruit and train and put a new officer out on the street, we had a sizable salary savings during those times where we were in the recruitment process. And so this time it is going to work out fine for us, and I don't see it impacting our service levels at all for this budget year.
So this is all salary savings that we're looking at?
I believe the vast majority of that is salary savings from the positions that were vacated and we were recruiting for, if you remember, earlier in the year.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions?
Chief, can I just ask for clarification, because I might have missed something. Is that basically a one-time savings during the gap that you didn't have people in place, or do we still not have people filling those positions?
No, we've hired people in those positions. I think you remember seeing them come to council when we've introduced them. It was during the time period someone leaves, goes to another agency, for example, and then we're recruiting and then training the person that comes in.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I have two more follow-up questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The remodel is going to be about 10,000 square feet. What was the, if anyone remembers, was the cost of the new police station about $4.1 million? Does anyone remember? That's Jim's.
We don't have that data with us.
Okay. Does anyone remember how big the station was that we proposed, the square footage on that?
Yeah, I believe that station was closer to 15,000, between 14 and 15,000 square feet, and I think the cost was between 5 and 6 million. I think it was closer to 6 than 4.
Right, the estimate. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions? Okay. Once again, not a public hearing, but anyone in the audience would like to come forward, we'll be happy to hear from you.
Good evening. My name is Barbara Stickler. I'm the owner of GLR Construction, who is the lowest bidder. Honorable Mayor and City Council, thank you for letting me speak. We understand, as well as the others in the discussion that's going on right now, is that all of the contractors came in over budget. But we feel that we can help you find the monies there and the solutions that we have in value engineering of the roof, especially. That's a huge one right there. The concrete resurfacing, the vapor control system, the landscaping, and other items also. So with that said, we would like for you guys to allow us to help you value engineer this. We're a capable contractor. We work with the federal government. We do value engineering all the time. So it's nothing that we can't do, and I feel that we earn the right to do this because of the fact that why bring other contractors in? And the contractors that did bid this were we were all within a certain percentage, and it was a very, very tight bid. And, you know, we left less than $5,000 on the table between us and the second bidder. So we know we're all looking at the same thing. And we did receive bids after the fact that were lower. So we know that we can cut costs by renegotiating with our subcontractors and by doing some more value engineering. So we'd like for us to give us the opportunity to do that. And there is
ways that we can do credit modifications in the contract if it's allowed. We can't do that. We have done that before in the past. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Anyone else who would like to come forward?
My name is Danita Sire. I'm also with GLR Construction. I'm the operations administrator. Been in construction for a little over 11 years now and have worked with on numerous projects for various contractors throughout the state of California on military reservations all over the state, and have numerous times been put into positions where the government's budget doesn't meet our estimate, where our estimate when we submit the bid is significantly higher than the government's budget.
Hi. My name is James Sparks. I'm GLR's senior project manager, and it's been my pleasure to have been associated with Barbara Stickler, the owner, for 19 years now. Both of us worked for two companies before Barbara formed her own company about 7 years ago. And I've also had the pleasure of working with Danita, who you just heard from, and Chris Torres, our young and upcoming estimator, for several years now. My construction experience for the last almost 20 years has been performing contracts for various government agencies, most notably the federal government, but I have done some state jobs, mainly state universities and some school districts, a lot of projects out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, and starting to do some up the coast at Fort Hunter Liggett. I've done design builds, design bid builds, already completely designed jobs such as this one, and just worked off of statements of work and developed work plans, which are basically a bunch of sketches and cut sheets of different types of the different equipment, lights and stuff that will be used in the project. What I'm trying to say is I'm flexible. That is that I have experience and I'm flexible with working with both the customers and the architects and engineers and the end users to come up with a product that is definitely the best value for the customer. You know, I've heard a lot of things here tonight, wanting to get a long life or a longer life out of the project for the money that's now being talked about. Wanting to maintain some of the architectural integrity, well, and of course maintain the security considerations. That the police department needs. And as Barbara already said, we've proven that we can be competitive by being the lowest bidder on this project. And if you give us a chance to work with the city staff and the architect and whoever else may need us to work with, rather than putting this project back out to rebid, we believe that we can produce some significant cost savings right away, get this project moving off the ground, and that it'll be performed in a manner that meets or exceeds everyone's expectations. And thank you for giving us the time to speak here tonight.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
I would like to have some answers, just very basic questions. What's the sunk cost at this point?
I'm sorry, say again.
The sunk cost in the project. How much have you spent on the project?
Have you got that handy, Teresa?
Well, if you don't have the answer, you ought to have that answer. Second of all, what's going to be the incremental cost to finish the project? That's question number two. What was the schedule originally, and what will be the schedule? All right. Now, there's one thing I have a passion about, and that's our police department. you asked the right question. Operationally, what happens to the police department? We have kicked them around enough on this project with the beginning with the effort to combine police forces of Grover and AG, which I was in favor of, and for the new building, which I was in favor of. And I am very concerned at this point, not so much that it's going to cost them more money, but that we completely maintain the efficiency of our police department. Okay? If you're putting anything in jeopardy, it's not the balance sheet or the money. It's the issue of our police department. Errors of this type take place all the time. All the time. The old story is, what does a train timetable tell you? You know the answer? What does a train timetable tell you? It tells you how late the train is. Okay? These projects are always... Lou, you've gone through this, and you have too, all right? So my impassioned plea to you, do anything that's wrong.
There's a lot of money that's already been spent. And I don't have any problem with the bidders that came up and said, you know, we do this all the time and we're trying to do the right thing. This is nothing against your profession and what you do and how you came about what you did, and I don't want you to think that it is. to have a mistake of this magnitude does not happen all the time. This is a big mistake for a small city. And we hire consultants so that we do that very thing. We avoid those mistakes. And so, while I can't undo what's happened, I'm very, very disappointed. And I do think we should not accept the bids, and I do think we should start over. It's my understanding from Mr. Carmel's rather succinct answer, we can't just accept a bid and then do change orders to make it fit our budget. And I appreciate the succinct answer. It was helpful. So, I think we need to rethink this. And in terms of the whole value engineering, I think anybody that puts a bid forward that wants to get the bid should do that as a natural consequence of what they do as part of their business. And so there's a lot I could say, Mayor, and you know I like to get long-winded, but I'm going to stop. And I'm just telling you that I'm very uncomfortable. I think we should all be uncomfortable. And I don't really put it on staff. I don't think staff did any errors from my estimation. So with that, I would go along with staff's recommendation.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Barnidge.
I knew you were coming to me next. I felt it. Well, I would echo what Tim said. It's I haven't been on council that long, but I've been on planning commission, and this seems like a large mistake. Actually, when I told my husband the amount, he kind of did a double take, and he's in city government in Santa Maria. So I think this is a big deal because we are a smaller city, and but I'm struggling with how to move forward because the police are in a temporary building that's cubicles over there. It's not the greatest situation. So I'd like to get this moving. The contractor came up and talked about value engineering it. They can do some cost savings right away. But Tim said that we can't really do that. So I think the economy is probably partly to blame for the bids coming in high. I think that the economy just in the last couple of months is different. So I do think that's probably that's what the mayor had said, and I would probably agree with that. I worry about going back out to bid because of the extra time. I think 2 months is I don't know if 2 months seems really quickly to turn it around. I don't know if I have faith that that's going to happen. And so I'm disappointed, and I will just go along with the will of the council because I want this to move along. And I think that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you again, Mr. Mayor. Well, ultimately, I think we have to go forward with this as expeditiously as possible. I don't think we can afford to go starting from scratch. I don't think we can cut ties with the consultants we've used, the architect. I think we have to move forward as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Excuse me. There's a lot of moving parts here. We've got the police department. We've got the police facility. We've got the women's center. We've got the services to the community. We have to keep all these things balanced and excuse me, and appropriate. I think I like staff's recommendations. I think looking to find ways to cut the cost for the roof, cut the cost for the fence, without sacrificing security that fence provides for the parking lot, for our officers, for their equipment, for our equipment. That can't be sacrificed. But anywhere we can find savings, we should look. But I don't think we should look for savings today that are going to cost us more tomorrow. And specifically, you're talking about the energy efficiency. We're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Yes?
It just keeps turning itself off. I will start that I think both Councilmember Brown and I were somewhat suspect of these estimates in the beginning because they were so much lower than the estimates had been when we were looking at it compared to the new station. In fact, I think there probably were some of the same issues as far as bidding and value engineering and then comparing. As I remember, we were comparing the new station to the Salinas, which was built at the perfect time, the opposite of the perfect storm, I guess the perfect calm. If you'll remember, when we redid the streetscape here in the village, we got a great deal, and now we're on the other side of that. I am disappointed that you can't reverse change order and actually reduce costs through a change order. I'm a little surprised at that, but your answer was pretty clear. As far as the sunk costs, I just want to know, the biggest sunk cost by far is the fact that we've already moved the police department. I mean, we're sunk. We have no choice but to move forward with building this building. That's the number. I'm actually quite confident that the new costs are fairly accurate. We did have 10 bidders. They were tight. If there, I doubt we'll have 10 bidders again, but we'll have, we know that a lot of people were interested in doing this work, and we're not changing it that significantly. And I think that's probably my biggest concern here is we're delaying 2 months minimum, and like I think that's optimistic, to save $200,000. And not that $200,000 is nothing, but it might not really be $200,000. It might really be $180,000, and it might really be 3 months. So my only hesitation in going through the rebid process is that is not the unknown of what it'll cost, but how much more time it will take. And that's really my only hesitation here. But I tend to agree with my fellow council people here that we just have to move forward. I'm inclined to set a time limit that says we're gonna set a date tonight that says we're gonna submit this bid on this date, so that we don't get caught up in just too many reviews. But I also recognize the unfairness in having to rebid. You guys are low bidder. And here we are, through no fault of yours, now everybody knows what the bids are, and that's inherently unfair. But it's just the way we're gonna. I do think that we're gonna have to proceed, because clearly the bids didn't come in close enough to our estimates. So my feeling tonight is that we would move forward. I'm inclined to set a three week date that says in 3 weeks we're gonna have the RFP ready to go, and let's turn this in my mind, ensure that we turn this around as quickly as possible, because we did in 3 weeks. We'd already be a month past our original opening and bidding date, and we have a month for the bids to come in. Even though, I don't know if we can shorten the period that you have to bid this. I don't know whether is there a set, this is has to be 30 days, something like that. It's statutory, whatever the period that the bids are out for. So, anyway, that's my inclination. I would like to see us actually set a date, a goal for staff that they're going to be done on this date. If we miss $20,000 in savings to save another month, I'm inclined to say that's the direction we want to go. And it assumes that we get it built on time. I mean, we haven't even dealt with the unknown unknowns that when we actually open up the building. So, anyway, that's my input tonight. I think we should move forward with the rebid and that we make it expeditious by setting a date.
Okay, thanks. Well, Tim, tell me, I have to ask this question. If we were a charter city, would this process be going a little easier?
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
I didn't hear you.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, very much so.
Thank you. I'm torn here. I think my first choice would be to award the low bidder, and even though we can't do any kind of formal negotiation or formal restructuring, take them at their word, and that would truly expedite this. And unfortunately, we're in a position now where we cannot do that, and so we're rolling the dice. If there's a positive in this, and I'm not sure I would even qualify it as a positive, recognizing that this was a major blip on the radar screen for reasons we're still trying to determine. Comments notwithstanding, if two of our council members feel that in the original estimate, the bid proximate $300,000 savings, and you heard the chief say that isn't coming from direct operating costs, it's coming from salary savings, which I understand that concept very well. So that's not going to put a bite into things. And then, of course, the rest of it, the $315,000 is coming out of our unencumbered general fund, which is our reserves. And fortunately, through the hard work of our staff and the fiscal conservatism of this council, we've been able to build that reserve up well over above our minimum requirement. So we have the money without it causing a significant impact to our budget. So if there's any positive thing to be derived from this, it's that fact that we can continue with our business here. That said, clearly we can't take too many more of these kinds of experiences. So to the extent that we can continue with the analysis to try and determine what happened here, and with a view towards ensuring that it doesn't happen again, that's clearly what we need to do. So I'll support staff's recommendation. I'm not sure if a time limit is possible. If it is, I'm willing to support anything that will move this thing along expeditiously so that we can get this thing back on track. So,
Mr. Mayor, the manager, and to a certain extent, I want to clarify something. I don't want to muddy the water anymore. Your ability to negotiate before you award the bid is virtually non-existent. After you award the bid, you have the ability to negotiate. The problem is there's somewhat of a leap of faith involved in that negotiation.
Right.
And that's really what I'm trying to underscore. They have no obligation to negotiate.
Right.
They have an obligation to build the project they bid at the price they bid it for. And that's kind of the picture that I want you to keep in your head. So if you go down that pathway, there's a lot of faith involved and a lot of hope, and which is not to say that can't be achieved, but there's no certainty in that process.
Right, and I understand that, and that was the reason why I said if we award the low bid, we would take them at their word that we would work towards a cost reduction, certainly not anything that we could hold them to. So I get it. So, all right.
End of my comments here. Actually.
What's that?
I mean, emphatic, the way I understood you say that to us was that you could not, I wasn't referring to negotiate. I'm talking about after you rewarded the bid that you could in fact have what I'll call a change order that reduces the price. That's not really a negotiation. Now, I understand where that's a huge disadvantage. But the worst case scenario is that we build exactly what we've got and it costs us $200,000 more. The best case scenario is that we save the $200,000 and are done 2 months earlier.
Right, and I think what I mean to say is to use the change order process to fundamentally redesign your project to bring it down and cost $700,000 is somewhat outside the norm and really does have some challenges to it legally.
We're actually talking about $200,000, not $700,000.
I think if you're looking at the staff report, if you're looking for overall savings, you don't know what you're looking for. That's why you're rebidding the project. I think they've targeted $200,000 in specific improvements that don't necessarily have to be built at the specification level that are in the specs right now. Which is not to say you can't achieve some reduction in project costs, but if you award the bid knowing that ultimately you're going to be fundamentally changing the nature of the project that was bid, there's a lot of limit. Legally, there are limits involved in how far you can go there, because that's really what you're saying.
When you say how far we can go, is it that we can't go less than 10% under the original bid, or legally, like you say, they're under no obligation to do anything?
They're under no obligation to do anything when
you're designing that project. I understand the risk. I absolutely do. I understand the risk. I still think I'm going to suggest that maybe to the council that maybe it's worth the risk.
May I ask a question? What I think I see happening here is that hypothetically we would award the bid to the low bidder, and then we turn around and we say, but we already have identified that we don't want the fence built the way we said, and we don't want the roof built the way we said. Mm-hmm. And let's take them at their word and say, well, they came in and they said, we can do that, and they saved us $200,000 or $250,000 or whatever. Would the other nine bidders have the ability to come back legally and say, hey, wait a minute, we saw what you did, it was in an open meeting, we could have done the same thing and saved you $300,000 or $400,000. You did not give us the opportunity to do so. Your process was inherently fair. We're going to sue you.
That's the essence of the problem. The second low bidder was $5,000 away in price. They're all bunched up very tightly here. We're under incredible scrutiny, and I can assure you if that's the path you go down, there's a reasonable likelihood you'll have a bid protest.
April 18th would be Friday. April 18th would be 2.5 weeks.
We're debating. Of course, the concern is just getting the information that we're seeking from various contractors and making those, if any, design changes in the plans. We think we're a little uncomfortable with it, but we think we can.
Oh, okay. Then I'm just going to make the motion that we reject all the bids, direct staff solicit new bids after modifications are made to design as quickly as possible. Also move we adopt transfer $300,000 from the police department budget to the police station upgrade project budget, and we appropriate $315,000 from the general fund unappropriated fund balance to the police station upgrade project budget.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Any? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Aye.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. So thank you, folks, for taking time to be here. I'm sorry it came out the way it did. Okay, we're going to move on to item 11A. This is the Water Wastewater Financial Plan and Rate Study.
evening again, Mayor, members of the council. I'm Debbie Malicote. As you're aware, we periodically review water and sewer rates to make sure that these enterprises are generating enough revenue to support themselves. They're not supported through general taxes. They're supported through user fees. The last rate review was done in 2009, and it resulted in some substantial rate increases over the past 5 years. And those actions have led to the stable and strong financial condition of the city's utility funds today. As you will hear, the water and sewer funds are in a good financial condition. The sewer fund is projected to remain stable, and therefore no increase in sewer rates is needed at this time. And only modest rate increases are necessary for water. In 2013, the council awarded a contract to Reftelis Financial Consultants to study the water and sewer rates. And tonight we have with us Habib Isaac here to present the results of that study.
Thank you, Debbie. Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Aurora Grande, city staff, as well as the public. Habib Isaac with Reftelis. And as Debbie mentioned, I'm going to go over a general review of the report that was presented to you. It's a draft report. It becomes final once you actually have a public hearing on the matter. But we'll go through both utilities and some of the recommendations that we have for you. So one thing we're going to go through is what is your current financial position under existing rates that you have today and the revenue that it generates? 5-year, 10-year projections based on those rates as well as the recommendations. And then ultimately impacts to the utility in terms of annual revenues and net cash, reserves, debt coverage for your water enterprise, and then also what the recommended adjustments and rates would be, and in discussion. But please feel free to ask any questions while I go through this presentation. Starting with the water utility, when we look at current water financials, the one thing that we always want to do is not just take the budget numbers, but also look at what's my revenue when we look at the number of accounts based on their usage and the rates that are currently in place. So we multiply the price times the quantities to make sure it's close in the projections. From an annual standpoint, in the next couple years, you are meeting your revenue requirements and you actually are generating a surplus to build your reserves, and you're also meeting your reserve minimum balances. Your debt coverage is also satisfied. You have the debt with the Lopez Fund, and it's 125% coverage. However, as you look farther out into future years, by 2018-19, you will slightly be below that debt service coverage. So in terms of recommendations for the water enterprise, in terms of financials, we definitely want to make sure we comply with bond covenants over the planning horizon, generate positive net cash, not just in the first couple years, but in all years. This will allow you to fund your CIP through a pay-as-you-go basis. You do have debt with the Lopez. However, all your capital right now and as is projected is going to be funded through PAYGO. So you need to make sure you have adequate reserves to do so. And then based on these objectives, you just need to implement very measured revenue adjustments of 1%, 2%, and then 3 years of 3%. Over the last 2 years of me doing a number of rate adjustments and updates, this is now just the second time where it's just been very modest, mild adjustments that are necessary, which is good to see. You're in a very strong situation right now. So here, this first graph shows you where the bars represent those revenue adjustments, 1%, 2%, 3%. And then you'll see the red trend line is your debt service coverage, and it's well above the 125%. And then in terms of your operations, you now would see, based on those 1%, 2%, 3% adjustments, you would then generate slight surplus in funds that would then go to your reserves. So with that, your reserves are over your minimum, and we always recommend you definitely have over your minimum when you do PAYGO, so you don't see, as your capital improvements fluctuate, that you would then dip underneath your minimum every year when that happens. The minimum is you want to make sure that you're always above that amount. And then building up your reserves and doing PAYGO allows you to do so. So the CIP is fully funded through this PAYGO approach. Now, that's the financial plan. Now the question is, how do we recover that revenue? So there's two sides of the coin. One, we got to make sure the utility is financially stable and have the appropriate amount of revenue. Now we got to see how does that revenue recover from your customer base. Right now, and what we recommend is that you do have two separate components. One is your fixed charge, which is the bi-monthly charge to all your customers. And then the other one is your variable rate, which is based on usage. With fixed revenue, that's a function of costs being spread over the size of the meter, as well as certain costs being spread over just number of accounts or units. A good example of that would be customer service or billing. Every customer gets a bill. It doesn't matter what size meter they have. That cost should just be uniform over all units. And same with customer service. Any unit, whether it be a business unit or a residential unit, has the ability to call the city and ask questions about the bill. Now, there are a couple adjustments that we recommend. One of them is to eliminate the outside rates. Currently, you have two separate rates, one for inside residents and one for outside the city limits. There's only a handful of accounts that are outside. I think it's right around 10. And it's not anticipated that this service is going to expand in terms of more customers being outside the city limits. And usually what we see is when we do have inside customer rates and outside customer rates, usually it's because there's a significant cost to serve those customers, such as additional costs related to a pump station, or there's another supplemental water source that they use as opposed to inside city customers. And you know, to comply with Prop 218, which governs these types of fees, you have to show the cost incurred and then do pretty heavy accounting of showing separate costs and how the revenue goes in and goes out. And with just a small handful of accounts that isn't going to grow, it doesn't really quite make there's not a cost benefit to do so. So what we recommend is to have all customers be on the same rate structure. And then also we recommend just having one bi-monthly charge that includes the Lopez charges. Right now your bi-monthly charge is broken out between two fixed components. And to do it, what we recommend is that make it one cost for a fixed charge. There's two things to that. It simplifies the rates for your customers to look at when they look at the schedule of what's my cost, so they don't have to sum a number of different tables. And then secondly, ultimately, all your revenue should start in the operation fund, and then whatever cost you incur for Lopez, then you should just pay that cost. But if there's funds that are in addition to that, those should stay in the operation fund, and it's not like Lopez has its own revenue source. It's still from your customer base. Moving along, as I mentioned, one thing that we saw was the fact that there's a cost per account or per unit. I gave the example of customer service or billing tiered rate structure. That was something that seemed a little counterintuitive in terms of what the current drought conditions are of the state, but I'll go in a little bit more detail in the next couple slides. And then you also have separate charges for hydrant and wheeling, and those were updated as well. Now, in terms of the fixed charge, as I mentioned, there's two components, costs that are spread over all units. So this is customer service cost. So from that standpoint, every unit will be charged $7.40. And then there's costs associated with the size of your meter, where the bigger the meter is, the more you should pay because you have a higher demand on the system. So the 1993 represents the 5/8 meter. And then looking at 2014-15 rates for fixed charges, what I have here is just each of the different size meters. And then here's the account charge. So that doesn't change based on size. It's just that the fact that you have an account, you get charged at 740. But then the cost associated with the size of your meter, this is where it does slightly change as you move up the schedule of the size of meter. And then the meter service ratios, this is the ratios that were applied, which is based on America Water Works Association ratios that relate to the size of the meter and the demand it places on your system. So the sum of those two equals the fixed charge. And since you charge bimonthly, it would be this rate times two. And then moving along, because we, in our report, we're projecting for the next 5 years, so what your rates would be with that 1%, 2%, 3%. This shows the 5 years of fixed charges by meter size. And then you also have private fire lines, where commercial entities also are required, based on building code, to put in a fire line. So we also updated those rates as well. But in totality, in terms of revenue requirements of your $6.5 million that's coming from rates, it's a very small amount that's coming from the private lines. In total, in a year, it's around $60,000 that's being recovered from these rates. So it's very, very minimal. But we're still showing the full schedule based on size of the connection. Even though you may not have some of these connections, you might in the future. So we show the full schedule. So those are the fixed charges. I'm now going to move to the variable component, which is based on the usage of your customers. One thing we always look at is, what is the current makeup of your usage? Residential is a tier structure. So what we do is we analyze your consumption data that was provided to us, and we look at how much consumption is coming from each of the tiers. So we look at the full year of consumption, and you'll see that in terms of how much consumption is in each tier, we have 44% in tier one, and it slowly steps down, which is what you expect, where once you get in tier four, it's a smaller percentage. The one thing typically you don't want to see is your highest tier being 25% or more of your revenue, because it becomes very volatile in terms of people conserving their water use. So when we saw the tier four, it is only 4% of your overall usage, and that's at 512. And because of the current conditions of the state, this is where you're going to see your reduction in consumption. This is where your residential customers may be able to pull back on their usage, where most likely is for outdoor use, and it's not essential use, such as for your indoor needs, washing, showering, things of that sort. So with that, we have some recommendations in terms of what your tier should be and the allotments, how much water should be for each tier. The other thing with Prop 218 is, not only do you need to make sure that you have a sound council service between the customer classes, you also have to have a rationale or nexus as to what was the breakpoint for your tiers. So with this approach, what we do is, we want tier one to be for essential use or for your indoor needs. And we looked at the winter quarter average of customers' usage of residential, because typically, based on industry standard, winter is used as a proxy for indoor use, because your outdoor usage typically is reduced down to almost negligible. Granted, there's some customers that probably don't turn off their irrigation at times, but as a group, typically this is what you see. So the average usage during the winter of your customers, residential customers, is 15 CCF. That's units of water. And one thing, it's one thing to look at, okay, here's the average usage during winter, but what does that mean in terms of gallons per day per capita? It's also important to I know from another calculation, how much water are we giving each person? And we did that as well, just to make sure it made sense. Because if we saw the average use of water, so what we recommend is for Tier 2 to be an additional 18 units. Again, we want to give a little bit of buffer, where the combination of Tier 1 allotment and Tier 2 allotment is 36 units, which is 4 units above the average for summer. So again, from month to month, it may fluctuate, and from account to account, you may fluctuate a little bit based on the size of your lot. So we wanted to have a little bit of a buffer there for those type of customers. Then, once we now have rationale for the tier one, we have rationale for tier two, and now tier three is just anything above that. Moving along, when we look at now how does the consumption look in terms of the new breakpoints of the tiers, you now would have a little bit more revenue coming in tier one, which is again, the most stable revenue when it looks at variable. This is the amount of consumption that most customers are always going to be using. And then tier three, as you move to the higher tier, is 15%. Again, it's under that 20% that you typically don't want to get over. And then in terms of the rates, you'll see that tier one is actually less than your current tier one, and tier two is less than your current tier two, but tier three is pretty much a blend of tier three and tier four. So the one thing I want to emphasize is we're making sure that we still have affordable rates for your essential users or those that are on fixed incomes. Typically, you expect them to also be very efficient with their use, and we provided that. And that's one benefit of having tiers is that you then could structure tiers in a way that you're providing a benefit to those that do use water very efficiently. Now, in terms of the 5 years for variable rates, you'll see that single-family and multifamily has the same rates, similar to how they are today. The only difference, though, is the allotments. With multifamily, they don't have the same amount of water demand or needs for outdoor usage, so their allotment per unit basis is a little bit less. Instead of another 18, it's half of that. It's an additional 9 per unit. But we do take into account the number of units. So, for example, a triplex, their tier one allotment would be 3 times 18 units of water because there's 3 residential units there. And then non-residential, as well as irrigation, similar to the rates today, are uniform rates. And then we updated the hydrant and wheeling rates. Hydrant rates are essentially the entire revenue requirements just as a variable rate. That's for one example of that when you would use is if a car runs over a hydrant and then you're losing water through insurance claim, then you could recover that cost. And then wheeling rates basically excludes low-pass costs as well as other cost components that are not related to just transmission or conveyance of using your water lines. One thing I also wanted to show you is besides the financial plan for utility as well as adjustments to your rates is what is the impact to your customers? Because that's also very important as well. That could guide some of your decisions. So this first table, the blue bars represent the usage of each tier, which is similar to that table that I showed you, 59% in tier one and 15 in tier two, three. And then the red bars, what those represent is we actually took the usage information of all your accounts and we plotted all the bills that would be generated and we looked at how many customers use tier one and stay in tier one. So how many bills are in tier one? How many bills end up being in tier two? How many bills end up being in tier three? So this is the bill distribution of your customers. And I also included tier four just to show you that we don't have a tier four. So there's no usage or bills in that particular tier. So you'll see that in tier three, 19% of all your bills are in that tier. Now looking at some other specific examples of current usage types for a single family, here's an example of a customer using 18 units of water, and this is a 5/8 meter. So one thing we're showing this in two different ways. One is just by bar graph showing the current costs versus the proposed bills over the next 5 years. The different colors represents the black is fixed charge, and the blue is the variable charge, which is the amount that will be charged based on usage. And then we also have a numeric format below and showing you the percentage difference. So for this person, that 18 units of water, the first year is actually a slight reduction. And then following that would be a slight increase each year due to that 2%, 3%. That slight reduction, one, is due to the lower cost of those tiers and also the inclusion of city water, so accounted for. And you'll see that under additional unit charge, these dollar amounts are now populated because there are additional units in that complex when compared to a single-family home. Again, there is savings in that first year, and then you see slight adjustments. Now, non-residential, similar graph. The one thing here, though, you'll see quite a bit of reduction in next year compared to this year. And this is primarily a function of city water paint being included, because although some cost was shifted over to non-residential, it's not enough cost being shifted as a whole compared to the cost savings from economy of scale, including more spreading their costs over more units of water, because all the city's water is in non-residential. So that is where you get economy of scale and why the rate for the first year goes down, where there's just cost savings there. And there's only a few slides for sewer, but if you want, I can pause and answer questions about water.
Go ahead, we'll ask
okay. After. Now, sewer, this is even in a stronger financial situation than water is. You have positive annual cash flow each year for the next 5 years and even in subsequent years. You're currently meeting reserves. There's no bond coverage that you need to maintain. And then based on our analysis, there's no revenue adjustments necessary at this time. But I'm still going to show you some of the financial plan and the cash flow. Now, you'll see here that we have the same operational costs by cost components. The black represents your surplus of revenues. But you'll see in fiscal year 2018-19, there's actually quite a bit of an increase in your capital costs. But that's just based on timing. And you'll see that typically it's around $200,000 a year, but then it goes up to $600,000. However, even though that spikes and you see that you have a revenue shortfall in that year, you still have sufficient reserves on hand above your minimum to offset that need. So this is why the reserves dip down in that particular year from the last year. However, if I go to looking out even further besides the 5 years, this is where you see that dip from fiscal year 2017-18 to 2018-19. You'll see that the utility enterprise recovers and then still is able to build up reserves in subsequent years. So unlike water, where it couldn't continue to keep up with cost and build reserves, the sewer at the current rates generates enough revenue where it could still continue to build reserves. If it wasn't able to, then we would be coming forward recommending some slight adjustments of 1%, 2%, or 3%. So those sewer recommendations are to have no adjustments at this time, maintain your current rates, and revisit it in 5 years if nothing substantive has changed. If there is a significant change in your cost, then you should revisit it at that time. And then also, we will provide the sewer model that we prepared for the city staff to use as a planning tool for future years. So with that, I'll open up for any questions or just general discussion you may have in terms of the utility rate study.
Okay, questions?
I don't.
Well, she's, okay.
I was figured looking for the beeping.
I'd give you some time to finish chewing, but, okay. Councilmember Costello?
I do have one question for you. Did your projections on the water analysis include any implications if the drought were to continue for another year or 2 years?
A good question. We do look at what your current gallons per day per capita is of your customer base and where you need to be in terms of SB7X-7, which is a 20% reduction by 2020. And we do assume a reduction in your water demand of roughly 2% to 1% over the next 5 to 10 years through 2020. And then you're reaching your goal of 149 gallons per day per capita at that point in time. So if it happens that you actually don't reach that goal, then that would basically mean that the rates that we have in place right now, or what we recommend, would generate even more of a surplus in funds that then would allow you to even mitigate some of those potential revenue adjustments in year 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Well, that's fine for year 6, 7, 8, 9, but I'm thinking if we have two more years of drought, we may reach the point where we have to impose some rather severe water savings measures on everyone beyond what might be considered reasonable at this point. But if the Lopez level gets down to a certain point, we'll be mandating that people are going to have to spend a lot less
that winter. And we've been using that in recent models. We've been using 2012, even 2011, for coming up with that winter quarter average.
Yeah, because I think even 2012 was significantly below average rainfall all year long. So I would be surprised if you're really looking at just indoor use in this area anyway.
And that's why we also do the back calculation to see what does that mean in terms of how much water we're giving on per capita per day. Where we look,
I understand you come up with 75.
Right, where if it was a very dry winter where people still use a lot of water even for their outdoor needs, we will find if we got to a threshold of say 90 gallons per day or 100 gallons per day, then we would go back and say, even though the winter core average states this, that's more than what's needed for indoor use. But 75 gallons per day per capita is pretty reasonable for indoor usage based on your density.
Okay. And like I said, I think the number's probably indoor use is significantly lower than that. The other question I had related to, so when you put in your projection, like I saw one, and I thought it was like 1% a year for the next 5 years, mm-hmm. you're actually projecting that we do end up at this goal of 149 acre feet, and we do have enough revenue to run the system at the 20% reduction.
Yes, that's correct. So what I'm doing is assuming that you are going to reach that goal, and rates are just one tool that you have in your toolbox to get to that goal. There could be also many other, there's a lot of other metrics that you could use to reach that. But one thing I'm making sure in the model is that if you do reach it, you're still going to generate the amount of revenue you need to run the operations.
That kind of segues into my final question and sort of concern here, and this is that basically you're telling us that under the 218 system, we cannot use tiers as a, we can't use the market as a way of achieving conservation, which is kind of counter to what's gone on in the past, and frankly, just went on in Pismo Beach. So I wanted to sort of question: is that in fact the case when you say we have to have a nexus?
Yeah,
the nexus of achieving a conservation is non-existent.
Yeah, it can't just be based on economics. It has to, or market pricing, it has to be based on cost incurred. So with a lot of agencies, we would look at what are your water sources. There's some agencies where at a certain threshold they have to import water. So that would be a basis for now that cost is that import water is only in Tier 3 or only in Tier 4. But you do have to show what costs are incurred to justify the difference in rates in the tiers per Prop 218. It can't just be a general multiplier that was done in years past.
Okay. And is that relatively new then?
I wouldn't say it's relatively new, but it's now more scrutinized.
Okay. And then the final, because kind of leads me to, here we are in the middle of a drought, and we're actually charging less. Your first year's bill is going to be less, which clearly, in my mind, sends the wrong message. It says use more water. And I guess if we want to adjust for that, we would adjust the first year's percentage if we wanted and lower the outlying year's percentage. And I'm wondering what that would do to your model.
Yes, that is an option. If you wanted to, I took a measured approach of stepping up the revenue adjustments to where you need to be, but you also could have a scenario where you want to have them level adjustments or step down. Those are options as well, but excuse me, because in some industries the economy is still recovering, it made sense to do more of a step-up approach and do modest adjustments to the point that you need and then level out from that point forward.
Okay. And then I guess this is a question for you and for staff. There was the $50,000 number in there for conservation measures, and we have that, plus I know we have the water availability fee on, which we'll have some of anyway going into the future. Is there any way, Steve, that you can tie that, now that I know there's a plan out there coming in May, for actually achieving this. Does that number tie back to anything in that plan, or did we just make it up?
Yeah, it's not tied very specifically. There's a little bit of analysis in terms of a ballpark figure of what we'd like to set aside to be available for those recommendations. It really ties to the the increased incentives. So we didn't do a sophisticated analysis, but we did do a little bit of a rough estimate on if
1-2-3-3-3 for 5 years. Is that going to be pretty much automatic if that happens?
It would, but you're not approving it this evening. You're just approving it to be noticed, and then it'll come back with the date, May 27th. So that would be the date. If you approve it then it would go into effect for the 5 years automatically.
Okay, given what we did earlier on another kind of progression issue, if we're looking at revenue versus operational costs, then that's your best guess right now. Given the fact that there are so many factors, some of which we've been discussing tonight, that could affect operational costs, when do we do a check-in here? I mean, could we condition this at some point in May when it comes back that if we go 1%, 2% before we go to 3%, or maybe we go 1-3% before we continue with that 3% increase for the remaining 2 years, we actually reassess where we are in terms of revenue versus actual operational costs. And that could affect whether we stay at that rate or whether that rate is even needed to continue. Is there a way of structuring that in to this study or this recommendation at some point?
I mean, we normally do that as part of the budget process. When we review these funds, we determine if we're on track, and at that point, if we're off, that would be the time that we normally would indicate that, hey, we need another rate study to potentially adjust the recommendations that have been made in the past. Now, with the sewer rate study, you have a lot of flexibility, so we're not implementing anything. So we're going to be looking at that every year, and you can come back at any time and start a new study since we're not going to have anything in place.
All right. So then best case scenario, through the budget process, we look at our water fund and we're much healthier than we thought we were going to be, we come back to this.
Just to clarify, we come back to another 2018 election, right? Yeah.
Okay.
May I just make one comment? I work with a few agencies where we do revenue tests each year, but in that situation, this is just your ceiling, and this is the amount you can't go over without going through a Prop 218 noticing again and a public hearing. But if you end up finding out that you have surplus funds or you have some cost measures and you're doing really well, then you could actually maintain what they are, that next year, or instead of, say, 2%, it's 1%, or instead of 3%, you implement 1%. The only thing you can't do without going through Prop 218 noticing again is go from 3 to 4.
Right, raise it.
Right, you just can't raise it.
You can reduce it.
Yeah, there's just the ceiling, correct.
Right, okay. All right, any other questions? Okay. Anybody would like to comment, please come forward on this item.
I think you require a projection of revenue profit on this. Your present margins of revenue and cost is 40%. I'd like to invest in that business. Look at your last year's financials. You're showing almost a 40% margin, revenue over cost. That's great. It's a cash cow. You're transferring out $1.5 million someplace. And I asked him, where does that go? You didn't know. I forgot to ask you. Where does $1.5 million go, profit? General fund? Hope so. Okay, that's my comment.
Okay. Anyone else? All right, seeing no one else, we will come back to the council. And
We have had so many items, I'm going to have to go back and repeat our sequence here. So I'll start with Councilmember Costello.
I'll try not to cough too much this time. I think that this looks reasonable to me, particularly with it being a ceiling that allows us to drop down if it's appropriate. I can support the recommendation from staff tonight.
Thank you. Councilmember Brown.
I agree. I want to confirm one quick thing. We have a revenue deficit in the water fund, right? Is that correct?
Not currently, but in future years.
We would.
Then there would be a slight deficit each year, correct?
Okay. That's, yeah. Other than that, I'm ready to go forward, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Councilmember Barnidge.
Yes, thank you. I'm ready to move forward as well. I like the idea that it's a ceiling and we can come back and adjust it if things look...
...the cost, and we may be able to reduce that. I'll point out that in another community, I run a hotel in a community close by, and the commercial properties had a 20-plus percent increase, which, based on your comments, makes me wonder where their nexus is in order to fund their... You want to comment on that, or okay? Well, yeah, 20-plus percent increase on commercial properties in order to fund the conservation efforts on residential properties. Something I didn't enjoy at all, but at least I anticipated it for my budget, unlike some other managers. But anyway, I'm fine with going forward this evening. I just point out, particularly to the commercial customers, that they probably have one of the best deals in the Five Cities area as far as commercial water rates go. Thank you. I'd like to hear your comment on that.
First of all, I have to say this is at the risk of getting fired for extending this any longer than it has to go. There is a provision in the water code that allows allocation-based conservation financing, and I don't want to complicate this anymore because I don't pretend to understand it. I don't know if you're aware of it. But Water Code Section 371 and 372 allow conservation-based mm-hmm. allocation pricing because it's used in this county. So I just wanted to say, I think it's way beyond the scope of what we're doing here, but it is available.
Yeah, colleagues from my firm helped draft that those provisions.
Okay. I want to echo Councilmember Barnidge's comment. I can't tell you how many rate studies I've sat through up here, many of them, and particularly at this hour when they're the last item on the agenda. Your report was very comprehensive, very well presented, and much appreciated, so it was good work there. I like the concept of the three-tier rate, and you answered my question with regard to the ability for us to, through the budget process, if no other way, to reassess our water fund and look at operational costs, and if a rate is a variation in the rate or rate adjustment downward is necessary, we can do that without much red tape or process. So that's a good thing. Comparatively, we heard from the Mayor Pro Tem, he's obviously a little bitter. But beyond that, if you look at San Luis Obispo, I think they raised their rates over 7%. Paso, I'm not sure if it passed or not, but they were trying to double theirs. So when we look at our rate increase here, it's modest compared to what other jurisdictions have done in this county. So I'm very pleased and happy that we're in this position. It's not the best of positions, and we're all applauding the rain outside. But hopefully, we'll get through this cyclical drought and get into better times. So I'm ready to move forward with this as well. And once again, I appreciate the work you put in the report. So who wants to try a motion?
Mr. Mayor, I move that we schedule a public hearing to consider adjustment in water rates and the water rate structures outlined in the study and direct staff to prepare and distribute a Prop 218 notice for the proposed water rate increase and 3, approve the recommended changes to the water and wastewater reserve policies.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Yes.
Motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Vernon?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. All right, we're going to move into item 12, which is City Council reports, and go first. SLOCOG did not meet on March 5th, but the RTA did meet. We reviewed our two-year budget assumptions for 2014-15 and 2015-16. We also approved some changes and consolidation of services for North County Transit Systems. We approved a labor agreement between the RTA employees and the local Teamsters. And we also approved a staff recommendation to reconfigure our reserve fund policy for the Transit Authority. Instead of having one big pot of money, the board approved taking that reserve and putting it into three separate reserve accounts, one for cash flow, one for capital projects, and one for operating reserves.
Did meet. We did a great report from PG&E on the economic impact of Diablo Canyon. Went through a lot of particularly the impact of when they are refueling and the number of people who come into the area for that particular project and the impact that has. I do not have any report for the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority. Actually going to have to check in because I think I must be off that mailing list. So I have to check in with Karen. Yeah, so that's my report. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Costello.
The APCD has its bi-monthly meeting tomorrow, so we haven't had a meeting since my last report. 560 Fire Authority met last Friday. Donated some radios that we had that were unusable for the fire department to Grover Beach's Public Works Department, at least found a home and use for them. And Mike Hubert is coming to the end of his term as our acting chief. We're going to retain him as a temporary part-time administrative battalion chief. And we'll be looking for a new chief again fairly soon. Also recruiting administrative assistant clerk to the board. And everything else seems to be moving fairly regularly along in terms of operations. Got some reimbursements for our strike team deployments, which offsets the cost involved. Actually, more than offsets the cost involved. Budget status report, we're under budget for this time of the year. And I think that's all I have tonight.
And Councilmember Brown.
IWMA actually did meet. It was a good meeting. They spent quite a bit of time talking about the move towards putting food waste in with your green waste, so that's going to be an issue that's going to be coming up and they're going to be talking about. RAC met. There's nothing germane to Aurora Grande to report at this time, Mr. Mayor.
Very good. Councilmember Barnage.
Yes, Zone 3 Water Advisory Board did meet. It was a long meeting, but some of the highlights, there's a zip line ropes park proposed for Lopez Lake. So that's kind of exciting. Have some, maybe generate some business out there for the water slide. It's going to be right next to the water slide, sort of behind it to the left. And not much impact on the environment out there because of the way it's positioned. It's basically off the ground, so it's kind of nice that there's not a lot of impact. There's parking already there. No surprise, there's not much rain forecast for March, April, or May. 2013 was the lowest stream flow into Lopez Lake. No surprise there. And then I tried to get the a graph that was in the PowerPoint that John Diodati presented, but he went on vacation. But it was interesting. I'll bring it to the next meeting. It was a slide of California and all the counties and how much water each county uses and how San Luis Obispo County, I think, going off of memory, uses the the least amount of water per household. So so that was interesting, and it was interesting to see what the other counties use actually. And then let's see, Homeless Services Coordinating Council. They did meet. The VA is making $6 million available to SLO County over a three-year period for services related to homeless veterans. So that's a that was exciting. That's a lot of money. The HSOC voted to endorse two supportive services for veterans' families' applications for grants. One of them was CAPSLO for $4,800,000, and then the other one was $1 million for the Good Samaritan Shelter. The CAPSLO's application proposes to serve 255 households countywide, and the Good Samaritan proposes to serve 350 households, primarily where we are in the South County area. And the grants are expected to be awarded the end of summer, and the start date for those would be in October. And then just some statistics for our county. There are 260 homeless veterans in SLO County, 900 veterans who live in poverty in SLO County. And the Tourism Committee has did not meet since our last meeting. Thank you.
Okay, very good. All right, we're going to move to item 13, Council Communications. Anything to share, observations, announcements? Nothing. Well, I do have a quick one here. I was, as I mentioned, I was back east for the National League of Cities. This was our congressional meeting that the NLC sponsors, and of course, the city of Arroyo Grande is now a member. Some interest in infrastructure funding, streets and roads, and utility infrastructure, all of that. And to try and build up the importance of that, and hopefully get it restored to the budget as at a funding level that it was at. Everyone from everyone that we talk to gets it. They understand. They're also very, very cognizant of the need for additional water infrastructure. Everyone's tuned into the drought that we're experiencing here. So that part of it was, you know, we didn't have to put much effort into that, so water, wastewater infrastructure was a high priority. The other thing we talked about was marketplace fairness, and that's an issue that the league is working on right now on behalf of small businesses, and it's simply trying to figure out some equity between the internet and brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop businesses that are truly being impacted by it. So that was an issue as well. So it was a good trip, good meetings, and everyone was welcoming and attentive. So I'm not sure what will come of it. You never know. Maybe nothing, but it was worth the effort, I think, and to let them know what's important for California. Okay, moving on to staff communication and... Before we do this, I wanted to mention, not only for the folks that are here, but for the benefit of the public, that I'm not certain about my colleagues here, but when I came back, there were a few notes in my mailbox and a couple of phone calls, and people were a little bit concerned about the Prop 218 ballot that was going around relative to the fire department, the fire authority, and mostly issues related to the privacy aspect of the ballot. I really didn't know what that meant until I took a close look at it and saw that unlike other Prop 218 ballots, this one required a signature on the ballot. And I didn't, you know, I didn't notice it at first, but it seemed, now I understand why people are a little bit upset about it. And the fact that the anonymity piece is now not not an option. I do understand, having been through it a few times, that in this particular case, a parcel number needs to be on there to identify the property. But the name of the party has always been on the outside envelope or somewhere else, so that when the ballot comes out of the envelope, it then becomes anonymous. So
That was the issue. And then also there was some confusion about the weighted ballot issue. And I know those are the two things that, we talked about, Tim. And I don't know if you know this, but I wanted to kind of add a third, and that is with regard to how the ballots will be tallied. That was also an issue that was an afterthought that after, you know, we spoke about this. So anyway, I've asked Tim Carmel to kind of elaborate on this and hopefully at least put some folks at ease, more at ease with this. So
first of all, with regard, can you hear me? With regard to the first question, and that's why must the ballot be signed, luckily we can blame the legislature for that one. The Omnibus Implementation Act for Prop 218 actually requires, it's Government Code Section 53753, requires that the property owner sign the ballot itself, not the envelope outside the actual ballot. And I have it here if you want me to read it, but it just says, each assessment ballot shall be signed and either mailed or otherwise delivered to the address indicated on the assessment ballot. So I couldn't really explain why. I asked a few people why they thought that requirement kicked in at this level. And I think it may be sort of an evidentiary matter, sort of a tracking mechanism, because in this case, as you know, and this sort of falls back on the weighting itself, you can withdraw your ballot at the prior to the end of the public hearing. You can withdraw your ballot. You can change your decision. And it may have something to do with the manner in which that's done at the hearing itself in order to allow the process to continue. I don't pretend to know that that's the actual policy reason why they why the legislature included that requirement, but it is statutory. So, again, I don't pretend to know why. I scribbled down some notes. I read them now. None of them really make sense. It's a very detailed statutory process in the Implementation Act. It's not just a simple, you know, mail them a ballot. It really delineates exactly how they should be tabulated as well. So that's the answer to that question without much of an explanation.
So is it then, so then do we assume that the consultant that the fire authority hired designed this ballot
and then entitled to 100 votes, and that's in proportion to the amount of special benefit that they're paying for. And it makes a certain amount of sense in the context of an assessment. So it may run hand in hand. In order to withdraw a ballot of any individual, it's going to have a very subjective, you know, a specific number that's attributable to that parcel. And the logistics of actually going through them and trying to pull them out, maybe one reason why they actually ask you to sign them, I think that could be done with the parcel number as well, so I'm not sure that's a good answer. And again, the weighting is done just based on the amount of the assessment. If you have multiple parcels, again, they accumulate them on a single ballot. So you may, if you had 10 $10 parcels, you'd be entitled to 100 votes. And it's that simple in terms of the weighting itself. The tabulation, I know they require an unbiased party to do the tabulation itself, and I can read you the actual provision dealing with tabulation. I don't know if you want me to. At the conclusion of the public hearing conducted pursuant to D, an impartial person designated by the agency who does not have a vested interest in the outcome of the proposed assessment shall tabulate the assessment ballot submitted and not withdrawn in support or opposition of the proposed assessment. I mean, it's a little bit more extensive than that, but that's pretty much it.
So in this case, if I understand it, in talking with the fire chief, it's the League of Women Voters who will tabulate these votes.
Right, and as I understand it, they've been accumulating those ballots over the course of the time that they've been accepted, and ultimately they'll do the tabulation after the public hearing.
All right, so who validates the outcome?
They do.
The League of Women Voters?
Ultimately, it'll come back to the fire board for final action, but yes, they're the ones that ultimately certify that result.
So does anyone see the ballots other than the League of Women Voters?
During the tabulation process, no. But interestingly enough, the provisions of that act also treat them as public records and require you to hold them for 2 years afterwards, which doesn't mean that they can't, the privacy issues can't be eliminated off the ballot itself. But I'm assuming if someone makes a public records request, the agency counsel will go through that process and redact anything that's of a personal nature. That's the way we would treat it. But, you know, I was surprised because they are public records. You know, oftentimes election materials are treated differently. This, as you know, it's a function of Prop 218. The legislature took the constitutional amendment and then regurgitated this this Omnibus Implementation Act that is pretty comprehensive. And actually, it has provisions that are somewhat, I'll say, greater than those required by the constitutional amendment itself. The amendment itself doesn't require that the assessee sign the ballot. That's actually a function of the Act. So there are some subtle differences, but I'm assuming there were some valid procedural reasons for requiring them.
So once they're tabulated, then they become public record. Anybody can have access to them.
Again, with the proviso that you can redact personal information that is under the Public Records Act, you're supposed to redact it, or at least it's an option.
Thanks for the additional information. So, all right. Then item 14, final community comments and suggestions.
First of all, I'm very impressed how hard you people work. Really, and I wish you would really go back to the proposal I made a couple of years ago. You ought to get paid $12,000 a year each, $1,000 a month. $60,000 a year budget. Why do you do that? To invite good people to run. Okay? Who wants to work their ass off like you guys are for nothing? Just the psychic income? Right? Now, regarding your last question, I'm very involved, as Joe Costello knows, with the with discovery on the Far Authority. We are contesting the issues of how they sent the votes out. They went out in to the property owners, and the return vote is paid by the Far Authority. Stamped envelope. Okay. The problem is that a lot of people didn't receive them. The first day I found two people on my street that did not receive the ballots. So my question was to immediately go to Mary Bassett and said, why didn't you send a return notice that they received the ballots? See, if only six ballots come back, all right, I have been reading 218. And as you understand, that's exactly the issue of the fire issue. The ballots have come back. So the amount of money that's weighed in the ballots determines who wins or loses. So the second thing is, I cannot corroborate, and I've tried to get the people to corroborate for me, what the engineering report says on how you charge various properties. I can't corroborate that with the list. I have the list. I go through it and I look at it. Wait a minute. It's all over the place. So I'm challenging that. I realize this is going to pass, but the issues we see are, at this point, lead us to believe that the only way we can get an adjudication on this is to take it to the grand jury. It's ridiculous, but we're dedicated to do that because we're not getting answers. And frankly, and I hate to say it this way, I really feel I've been stonewalled on this from day one. Now, fine. You know my attitude. I gave a great presentation, Tony, last night when you were away, saying, "Where's the thing I am concerned about is I wish that you went for the whole banana, $400. Instead of 66 a year." And I said, why? Your kids walking around today with cell phones, and it costs $40 a month per kid. And $66 is dinner for two and drinks at McClintock's. It's just peanuts. I'd like to do it right. And further, what's the incentive? If you could do it that way, you unburden the general fund by what you contribute.
Wow.
And I feel the same way about the police. You know, I'm bleeding over that issue, and I really appreciate the agony you're going through on this building. But the fact is, you know, let's go first class. Here's my analysis of what the problem is. In 2010, we were in depression. People were out of work. Your council was working hard. City manager was working hard to cut costs here. People being laid off. You took tough measures right around, okay? Now it's 2014, your point earlier. It's a different scenario economically, all right? Things are good again. People are working again, all right? We have a first-class city, okay? If you feel we need more money, state the problem. It's your opportunity in this election year. Positively. Okay? If you feel that your general fund should be $20 million, put the case out and show ways to make it happen. And 218 is a positive mission to make that happen. It's a different scene today than 2010. Things are much better. And then I say, on top of that, you need a bonus. $1,000 a month for you. Okay, Steve, you can make that happen. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Otis. Anyone else? John? Okay. All right. Well, we have two options here. We can forge ahead into closed session, or we can, Steve has given us the option of holding off until the next meeting. Everybody feel?
I mean, I would go to 11. I think that we can do it by 11 or sooner. I'm willing to forge ahead and so that we have less on our agenda, you know, because I know our agendas are busy. So that's my.
I was going to say, what is on the next agenda?
We have the charter on the next agenda, but not a whole lot else. So it is a lighter agenda next meeting. We were anxious. We do have our first SEIU negotiating meeting tomorrow, so I was anxious to get some direction. But for that first meeting, it's not critical. I could get by to the next meeting if you wanted to delay. So I think it's up to you what your preference is.
My preference would be let's call it a night. Well. All right, so in lieu of adjourning to closed session and the closed session itself, we are going to adjourn the council meeting, and we'll postpone this closed session until the next scheduled meeting. So, all right, we are adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen and madam.